fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space itself and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area that we call... Now that's weird.
Yes, welcome to another one. It's me, Hemsworth, at the helm through for 3 hours. Are we live? Hold on a second, I'll check. Ouch! Just pinch me arm. Yes, I'm definitely alive. Somebody in the chat room said to me earlier, is it live tonight? I said, no, I'm not here. Oh, it takes all sorts, doesn't it? Right, tonight on the show, lots coming up. Neil Hudson joining us in hour three tonight, and he forecast that at 8 a.m, somewhere in the world, there would be a thermonuclear device set off. Have we passed all 8 o'clock? I think we have, a.m., so I think he's got that one wrong. But we're going to be talking to him. I'm sure he'll have something to say about that in hour three tonight. And in hour two, Mike Oram. You may remember we had Mike on the show once before. He was abducted outside of Area 51 by what he believes to be the American military. And he's going to be telling us a bit more about that story and a whole lot more as well. I caught up with him after Weirdo 9, the conference a couple of weeks ago. He came down to Glastonbury, spent some time here, and we did a whole hour with him in Studio 2. So that's coming up after the break in hour two tonight. But in hour one, we've got something special for you. But just before I go into that, let me just catch up on the news of the week. The story that seems to be covering Facebook at the moment and various other sites where we've been discussing it, including blogs, is this whole idea that NASA are going to bomb the moon. Now, you all know the story, I'm sure by now, that on the 8th of October, they're going to fire a series of missiles into craters at the south pole of the moon, apparently exploring and looking for ice and water. Now, scientists are quite mixed on their views on this. Some believe that the moon is actually hollow in the centre and that this could actually cause the moon to go off its axis and come crashing towards Earth. Now, to be honest, I think that's pretty unlikely. But having said that, we don't know. Nobody has ever tried to carry out any sort of explosions in non-gravity in a situation like the moon before, as far as I'm aware. So it's going to be a first and anything could go wrong. Now, do you think the greatest minds in the world at NASA... What's that stand for? Never a straight answer. Oh, yes, that's right. Do you think the greatest minds in the world know what they're doing? And do you know what might just pee you off just a little bit more? Is that they're advising on their LCROSS webpage on NASA. If you go into NASA and just click on where it says LCROSS, L-C-R-O-S-S, which is the mission name, they're advising everybody around the world to have impact parties. Yes, why not? Let's all celebrate the blowing up of the moon. What a bloody good idea that is. Are these people... are they totally insane? Is it just me that's weird? Something really, really wacky is going on out there. I tell you, I'm not comfortable about it. Your views, ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk. Also in the news this week, the Large Hadron Collider. Yes, it's back in the news. They're firing up again, trying to get it up to speed. Is there any reason why they keep failing? Is it a case of outside sources are protecting us from that thing actually kicking off? It's been a while now, hasn't it? They've had several attempts and things keep going wrong. And bearing in mind, these guys, again, supposed to be pretty clever. You think they'd get it sorted out quite quickly. Something seems to be stopping it. Your views, ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk. And the other one, of course, the big story this week was we passed the 9th of the 9th, 09. Now, all the conspiracy theorists were saying the same thing will happen in Britain as happened on 9/11 in America, because it's 999, our emergency services number, as was 911 when they attacked the World Trade Center. Well, of course, 999 went by, and I'm not aware of anything particular happening. So is that another conspiracy theory biting the dust? And it asks the question, and poses the question, something I was discussing with a good friend of mine the other day. What happens if on the 21st of December 2012 absolutely nothing happens? Because let's face it, the way things are going, the sceptics are having quite a good time laughing at us guys at the moment, saying, look, you see, another one of their conspiracy theories hits the dust. Now, we're making all this big fuss about 2012, and probably rightly so. But what happens if absolutely nothing happens in December 2012? Is it going to do massive damage to the world of strange phenomena? Is it going to be the sceptics around the world say, see, we told you they were all nutters and nothing was going to happen? What do you think? ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk. Right, let's get into the first part of the story tonight. Something's happened over the last few days which has got us all sort of watching and paying attention to. Andrew Collins, just over a week ago, posted a video, a YouTube viral, up on YouTube with regards to a new discovery of what appears to be underground tunnels under the Giza Plateau. Now, I knew that there was something going on here. here when I had contact from J.J. Hertak, Professor J.J. Hertak, about an underground world under the Giza Plateau. So I knew there was something out there, but I didn't know what it was. Andrew's been out there, he's filmed down in some of these caves and tunnels, and he put a video up on YouTube. Now apparently he's had to take that video down. Now I can't go into the legal reasons of why, although we will try to get to that over the course of this hour. But I'm going to start off by just introducing a person who's been on the show many, many times before, and in fact just the last time we were talking, we were chatting about crop circles. Andrew, welcome to the programme.
Hello, Ross. Good evening.
Good evening to you. And thanks for coming on at such short notice this week, as this story is breaking. This is really a breaking news story, because Discovery Channel have picked up on it. Various other TV companies are picking up on it. What's happening?
Well, we've discovered the entrance to a cave underworld at Giza, one that appears to have been completely overlooked by the academic community, and was last entered perhaps nearly 200 years ago. A British diplomat and explorer by the name of Henry Salt in 1817 employed the services of an Italian sea captain and explorer named Giovanni Caviglia, and they went about investigating the Giza Plateau. They looked at the Sphinx, they looked at the Great Pyramid. But what's not known, and this was only actually really made public just a couple of years ago, is that they explored what they described as catacombs for a distance of several hundred yards beneath the plateau, and then came across a spacious chamber which connected with three others of equal size, from which went various other what they called labyrinthic passages, one of which Caviglia explored on his own for a distance of 300 feet further. However, because they didn't find any gold or treasure, they gave up and basically never returned, as far as we are aware. Salt recorded it in his memoirs, and although he intended his memoirs to be published, they were never published until 2007, when essentially they were leapt on by my colleague, the Egyptological researcher Nigel Skinner Simpson. He retraced the steps of Salt and Caviglia and felt that he'd found the entrance to these catacombs. And this corresponded precisely with a really mysterious tomb that's not recorded in modern times, just west of the Great Pyramid, and one that I'd been looking at for a year or so, because it was the focus of a bird cult. The mummies of birds and some animals had been deposited in there as if they were like offerings to some bird god or bird deity connected with the underworld. And I felt that there was some connection here with caves, but I had no idea what at the time. So bringing this new information in about Salt and Caviglia, I wondered whether the entrance to the caves were actually within this tomb. Now, we'd already been there and not found anything. But with this, we went back there in March 2008, and we searched. We couldn't find anything to start with, but eventually we found a tiny crack in the rock, and inside was this massive cave chamber, and out flew all these bats, colonies of bats, and we went into there, and this was the start of this cave system that we explored for around 90 metres before we had to give up due to bad air, and the fact that we just didn't have the correct equipment. And even though we went back there on three further occasions, learning more about the extent and nature of the caves, certainly we never reached as far as Salt and Caviglia, but we are dead certain that this is exactly where they went. So this was the beginning of the whole thing.
Now, the YouTube viral got thousands of hits pretty much as soon as you put it up, but you've had to take it down. Can you tell us why?
It was quite simple, really, and that is the fact that, you know, we're trying to work with the Egyptian authorities to better explore and understand the entrance to the cave system. It was suggested to me by the publishers that this wasn't going to do our case any good because, I mean, I come from a sort of musical background and, you know, if I'm going to publicise something, I do it with style and I put a 9-inch nails track on it. I showed these great sort of flash images of what was down there. And I'm afraid that even though it got, you know, something like 6,000 hits in a few days, which is pretty good, There was a lot of negativity on the forums, you know, saying that this could be anywhere, you know, what is this, some weird, you know, gimmick to sell a book or whatever. So I bowed to the better judgment of my publishers and pulled it down, and I will actually replace it with a nice, sensible interview, which you know all about because it was you that interviewed me for it, which should be going up over the next few days, and I'll tell the world about that when it does.
Absolutely, yes. Andrew came down here a couple of nights ago and we filmed an interview which will go up on YouTube very shortly. Now, it has broken as a major news story now. The Discovery Channel have got it up. I've just put a link in the chat room to that if anyone wants to have a look at that. It's in our chat room at nowthatsweird.co.uk. But if you go there, you'll see the Discovery Channel have picked up on it on a blog and have a Collins v. Hawass sort of approach to this. Now, what is the debate that's going on here, Andrew?
Well, quite simply, Dr. Zahi Hawass, who is the big boss of the Egyptian Supreme Council of Antiquities, the governing body of excavations and antiquities in that country, has come out and claimed that that they knew all about this all along, and that there is no cave system here. It's just simply a tomb, and that we got confused by the maze-like interior of this. Plus, he also quoted. He said, look, you know, this tomb is already known. It's mentioned in this book called Poulter of Moss, which is a standard reference source for all tombs in Egypt. And there's a particular volume that covers all the tombs of Giza and who excavated there, what was found, and the description of and the inscriptions, etc., etc. And he said it was in there. Yeah. But the only trouble is that it's not in Poulter and Moss at all, and nor is the tomb mentioned in any modern document that we've been able to find. And my colleague Nigel Skinner-Simpson has scoured the libraries in Cairo and in London, the academic libraries, and we've been able to find nothing about it. This is a totally unrecorded site. The last people we know went in there was Colonel Howard Vyse and the British engineer John Shay Perrin back in 1837, and even then it was just a meagre diary report of the fact that they'd gone in there and found these bird mummies. So, you know, it's been totally overlooked since that time. But what's even more bizarre is the fact that at the back of this tomb, you know, is the entrance into a massive cave system. Now, we definitely went up to 90 metres, maybe even more, I'm trying to be conservative, and yet Zahi Hawass says that it only goes for 35 metres, and that we got confused in there and thought we were in a cave system. Well, I can tell you that our library of photos show otherwise.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there, Andrew, because we need to go into a break. But I will just finish this by leaving some food for thought in this section for you, the listeners, to make your own responses to at ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk. On Hawass's website, he has a fan club, which was pointed out to me earlier on today, and he apparently seems to think that discovering Egypt should be left only to archaeologists and scientists, and that no other researchers should really play a part. Now, I don't know what you lot think about that, but do you think archaeologists are the only people that ever make discoveries? I tend not to agree with that, but I'll leave it to you to decide. ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk. We've had an email in already from Sharon in Farnborough on the moon bombing. She said, I wouldn't worry too much about America bombing the moon. Given their friendly fire record, they're far more likely to hit Jupiter. Lots of love from Sharon in Farnborough. Thanks, Sharon. You're probably right.
Email the show, ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk.
In the heart of Glastonbury is the Daisy Centre Angelic Healing Retreat, a truly serene and secretly special oasis of peace and harmony. We offer accommodation and workshop facilities for groups and individuals who are looking for a special healing experience to nourish the growth of the soul. Visit our website at www.daisycentres.com. That's www.daisycentres.com. Perk up your petals with Daisy at the Daisy Centre Angelic Healing Retreat.
The
Love and Light Events present
The Avalon Fairy Ball on Saturday the 3rd of October at the Glastonbury Town Hall. Featuring artists Brian Frow, Josephine Wall, Linda Ravenscroft, Peter Prokovnich, Courtney Davis and more. At the Avalon Fairy Ball there'll be music from the Dolmen, fairy fashion shows and much, much more. The Fairy Fair is open between 11 and 5pm and entry is free. The Avalon Fairy Ball starts at 8pm.
Tickets are £20, available from thefairyball.co.uk or 01736 330
Festival Times, the UK's number one free music paper. To find out where we're giving away our paper this summer, or keep up to date on band interviews and festival reviews, check out festivaltimes.co.uk for promotions and advertising, or to buy shares in the FT for only £1. Then call the team on 0203 2875 123. Festival Times, the new music paper for new music fans. Want to talk direct to potential customers? Then think digital, think video, think local, think In Your Face Media. In Your Face is a brand new media proposition targeted at affluent Bristol areas. We're currently installing digital wireless posters in wine bars, gyms and cafes, as well as doctors and dentist surgeries. And while they're waiting, they could be reading or watching your advertising messages. The technology is blindingly clever. The screens are operated wirelessly via the internet, so we can program the dynamic content that will appear on every individual screen. Slots start from as little as 2 pence. For more details, call us on 0117 942 0670 or visit our website at inyourfacemedia.co.uk. Visiting Glastonbury and looking for somewhere nice to stay close to the town centre? Then have a listen to what some of our previous guests have said about Barham's B&B. A hidden treasure, real luxury and excellent accommodation. Looked after so well in a really nice friendly atmosphere. Another 2 days at the best ever B&B. A friendly welcome, lovely rooms and a tasty breakfast awaits you at Barham's B&B. Check out our website at barhamsbnb.co.uk and for booking inquiries, simply email gene.hbarham@yahoo.co.uk or call us on 01458 837 875. Rates from just £35 a night. Take a walk back in time by visiting the Gauntlet Shopping Arcade in the High Street, Glastonbury. The Gauntlet is the town's newest shopping area, but set in an ancient walkway that oozes myth, legend, and real history. You'll find a wide range of shops offering a wide variety of products and always a friendly welcome. Visit thegauntlet.biz. The Gauntlet, Glastonbury's premier shopping thoroughfare. Visit the show's official website, nowthatsweird.co.uk, and meet the team behind the show.
Yes, welcome back. You're listening to the first hour of Now That's Weird with me, Ross Hemsworth, and my guest, Andrew Collins. And we're talking this evening about a discovery of a new tunnel complex underneath the Giza Plateau. Now, we were talking before the break there, Andrew, about Hoas saying that it wasn't where you thought it was. Could you have made a mistake?
No. I mean, you know, I mean, obviously when you get somebody like Zoe Hoas come up and say you have, you think, oh, God, have we? But both myself and Nigel Skinner-Simpson went back to the drawing board. We looked in this reference source, Poulter and Moss, make sure we hadn't missed anything. We haven't. That seems to have been confirmed now. You know, and today I spent the day re-going over every step that we made inside the caves, trying to work out how far we went, where exactly we went, you know. And the one thing that it's told me is that we definitely were somewhere that Zoe Hoas says we wasn't, basically, and we've got the photographic evidence to prove it. I mean, he claims that this is all some man-made tomb, and it's clearly not. I mean, people can, you know, look at my site, you know, andrewcollins.com. There's a multitude of stuff on there. There's loads of photographs, you know, of the caves. They are a natural cave system. They were probably made by the actions of water tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years ago. And they were there when the pyramids were built, and the chances are that they were accessed from above ground. And the ancient name for Giza was Rostau, which means the mouth of the passages, a sure reference to some connection with caves and an underworld environment. You know, and the whole funerary literature of ancient Egypt talks about the deepest part, actually calls it Rostau, and, you know, says that the god who presides over this is Sokar, a falcon-headed god. Sokar was also the presiding deity over the part of the necropolis serving the city of Memphis that includes the area of Giza. So in other words, that was the local god, the local bird deity. And I think there is a good chance that the bird deity involved with these bird mummies that were deposited in what we call the Tomb of the Birds actually related to Sokar. They were offerings made to Sokar.
Hmm. Now, you say you didn't explore that far because of the bad smell and bad air that was down there. How far do you think the caves actually stretch?
Well, Sultan Caviglia certainly got, providing that their accounts are correct, and there's no reason to doubt it, at least several hundred yards. Now, where does that place them? Now, with the underlying geology of the plateau, that probably puts them in the area of the Second Pyramid. And it is my gut feeling that that's exactly where they go, and that the four spacious chambers that they came across, from which various other passages went into the darkness, are probably in the vicinity of the Second Pyramid, which is, an obvious place for them to head in many ways. But if that's the case, then there are many traditions and stories about a cave system on the eastern side of the plateau that links the area of the Second Pyramid with the Sphinx, and also another mysterious underground site called the Osiris Shaft, which has been much promoted and written about by Zahi Hawass himself. In fact, he's been down there recently looking for hidden chambers and tunnels. So it is very likely that we found the entrance into a cave system that spreads, like some kind of Swiss cheese, beneath the entire plateau at Giza. And what's interesting is that there is a number of creation myths and funerary texts from ancient Egypt that talk about this underworld realm containing this hidden chamber, this secret chamber. They say that it's the place of death and birth, rebirth of Osiris, the lord of the underworld. They call it the Shetiet, which means quite literally the tomb of God, basically, or the womb of God. And also, it is said that within this underworld is the womb of the sky goddess Nuit, spelled N-U-T or N-U-I-T. And that this is not just beneath the earth, but is reflected or mirrored in the sky within the stars of Cygnus, the Northern Cross, which we know from classical mythology as the Great Swan. And this area of the sky, or this area of the Milky Way, it breaks into two to form what's known as the Cygnus Rift, which is a dark area that carries on down to where the sun is basically born around the time of the midwinter solstice. In fact, it features in the whole 2012 alignment of December 21st. The new sun of 2012 is born from Cygnus. Well, the reason why I got onto the area of the Tomb of the Birds in the first place is that we were following up astronomical alignments involving Cygnus and the plateau, which seemed to put an importance in this very area where we found the entrance. And we think that this entrance does correspond to the same area of the sky known as the Cygnus Rift, marked by the stars of Cygnus.
Well, someone's actually preempted that with a question I'm going to bring in right now, actually, Andrew.
Okay.
Says, hi, guys, really enjoying the show. Ross, can you ask Andy if there's any astro-archaeological dimension to his recent discovery, or was it inspired by the old diaries? Looking forward to the PQ weekender, that's from James Martin.
Brilliant. Well, the answer is absolutely yes. I mean, most people associate the Giza pyramids with the constellation of Orion, and suggest that their placement reflects or mirrors the belt stars of Orion. But to be honest, when you look at that theory closely, the alignment is not very good at all. And a few years ago, a colleague of mine, Rodney Hall, an engineer, looked at whether the stars of Cygnus, which was popular amongst cultures around the world as a place of entry and exit to the sky world, that whether its key stars, the stars that make the wing of the celestial swan, actually reflect the positions of the pyramids, and it works better, it's almost perfect. And on that basis, we looked for further astronomical archaeal alignments, and there were loads of them connected with Cygnus. And we are now dead certain that Cygnus, and not Orion, is the key constellation associated with the Giza Plateau. But more importantly, the bright star of Cygnus, which is called Deneb, falls in the very area where we found the entrance to this cave underworld. I don't believe that that is a coincidence.
No, not at all. Now, I don't think it's a coincidence that Dr. Hawass has got involved at this stage and started making disclaimers on his website. Do you think there's something to hide there? Do you think he already knows of this system and for some reason doesn't want it out there?
I've got to be careful with what I say here, as I said to you before the show, because, you know, we try to work with the Egyptian authorities to, you know, to further explore this tomb, and we don't want to antagonise them. And I've already said a few bad things about Dr. Hawass on forums recently, but I mean the thing is that the guy has to be seen to be in control. You know, he is the big boss man in Egypt. He's probably after the president and Omar Sharif, the third most powerful man in Egypt. So if, you know, people who are not academics can come along and fight and make a huge find that becomes an international news story completely under the noses of the academics, the Egyptologists there, then in all honesty, this is quite an embarrassment, and I think that that's as far as I can put it, really.
Absolutely. Well, it'd be interesting to see what the listeners tonight think on this. Drop me a line, Ross at nowthatsweird.co.uk. What do you think on this? Do you think there's some sort of cover-up here? Do you think it's just a story that's opening up we're going to find a lot more out about? What do you think? What's your views? Get them in now, Ross at nowthatsweird.co.uk. Now, going back to the caves, you mentioned about the bedrock area, the Sphinx and the Osiris shaft. Now, I know there was some ground penetration radar team work done over that area. Did they pick anything up at all there?
Yeah, they did, yeah. I mean, they used more sophisticated equipment than anybody has done before, and bear in mind there have been various teams doing this since the 1970s. And it was an all-Egyptian team. And in 2006, they detected a number of hollows, cavities, what they believed might be chambers or tunnels quite deep beneath the surface. And when I say deep, we're talking around 15 metres down or more. I mean, obviously they can't tell exactly how far down they are, but their equipment certainly reaches that far. And the caves that we entered are about the same depth underground, I'd say, probably around 15 metres. And we believe that they permeate through the bedrock there, which is limestone, and the actual colour of the rock and the walls of the caves is actually a really sort of weird yellowy orange, and there seems to be quite a lot of oxidation in them, which I don't fully understand. I mean, in all honesty, I've yet to consult geologists about this. It's something that obviously is on the cards, basically. But it seems very much as if these caves permeate the whole of the plateau. But quite clearly, there's probably more than one entrance. We've found one. We think there's another within a well at the southeastern corner of the plateau. And others believe that there are entrances maybe in other tombs or extensions of tombs and things like that, although in all honesty we've yet to confirm that. But the one thing I will say is that there is a tomb guardian who we encountered. He couldn't speak any English, lives on the plateau, hardly ever comes in contact, you know, with Europeans, certainly in the area that we were, and he said that the cave complex goes all the way to the Fayum oasis. Now that's about 50 miles away. 50 miles, 80 kilometres. Now, that's probably nonsense, but it certainly shows that locally, amongst the Arab-Egyptian community, it was believed that these caves went for a very long way. The other interesting thing is that he told us that they are supposed to be haunted by this giant snake called El Hanash. And El Hanash, basically, is the guardian of buried treasure in ancient Egyptian tradition. He is like this sort of this spirit, this sort of demon, although he's not bad as such, that guards like this sort of treasure. There's only one Elven Ash, not like lots of them, and that he resides, you know, beneath the plateau within this cave complex. The reason why he wouldn't go into the caves himself, and I think this is fascinating because, you know, that there are stories that go all the way back to dynastic times about, you know, some kind of snake or snakes associated with the underworld in Egypt. And I think that this story of El-Hanash is some weird semblance or resonance of those stories that go back for thousands of years.
Mm. How old do you think the cave system actually is?
I think they were probably carved out by the actions of water tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years ago. The shape of the main cave passage is like a keyhole shape as you walk along it. And that is very characteristic of it being carved out by the actions of water. I mean, water will obviously try and find passages of least resistance as it passes through through rock. And although some people, even just in the past few days, have suggested that, you know, that the water might have been much more recent, you know, in the past few thousand years, I actually think that's really unlikely. It's much more likely that these are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years old. Which obviously means that if they were accessible to the surface, then we could be looking at finding evidence of early human activity down here that probably even predates the Pyramid Age.
Did you find any evidence of human bones or hieroglyphs or anything like that while you were down there?
There are no hieroglyphs at all, not in the Tomb of the Birds or in the cave. None, nowhere, which is intriguing in itself. The only artifacts that we've found was sort of mummy fragments here and there. And on one particular occasion, I picked up this sort of long cigar-shaped thing, which I worked out pretty quickly was a mummified animal of some kind. So I quickly placed that down in order not to contaminate any future archaeology at the site. The only other thing that we found, which was really significant, is that really deeply into the caves, some of the walls have been incised. You know, it's sort of been carved down in like sort of lines. Now, this can be to place plaster stucco on walls on which decorations may have once appeared, but the randomness of the placement of these in really obscure spots seems to argue against this, and I think there is some chance, a slim chance, that this could be decorative, and if it is decorative, that could predate the Pyramid Age.
Now, what do you think the implications are of the caves for the emergence of Giza as Egypt's most well-known pyramid field?
Well, it all goes back to the belief in the Duat underworld. The underworld was seen to pass beneath the earth. Now, whether it was seen to pass through it or beneath it is a matter of debate. And this was seen as the body of this sky goddess Nuit. Her actual body was the underworld. And it was through this that the sun was seen to pass at night. She swallowed it through her mouth at sunset, and she gave birth to it again the following morning on the eastern horizon. And so during the nocturnal hours, the sun was passing through this underworld. And so obviously this was the place of the regeneration of the sun in the deepest part of the Duat. That is where this hidden chamber, this secret chamber, was, known as the Shetiyet, you know, the tomb of Osiris, the place where Osiris would achieve rebirth. And I do believe that something like this probably exists within the Cave One underworld. It is some kind of womb of creation, a cave womb, you know, just in the same way that caves and later things like long burrows were seen probably as womb-like structures during, you know, the Neolithic period in Europe and elsewhere around the world. It has a similar function, and there probably was some kind of object representing, like, the seed or embryo within it, which is also talked about in creation myths, known as the Benet or Benenet.
OK, well, we'll stop you there, Andrew, because we've got to go into an ad break, but hold that thought, and we'll come back on that point in just a moment. We're with Andrew Collins. If you've got any questions for Andrew, get them into me now, ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk. We'll be back right after these words.
I smell something weird!
It's not weird, it's Ross Hemsworth!
You're listening to Now That's Weird with Ross Hemsworth.
Are you truly happy? Do you feel that there's more to life but don't know where to find it? More to Life magazine is the spiritual magazine to enlighten you with simple, easy-to-read articles on everything from angels, stress management and healing, through to Reiki, yoga and meditation. For just £13.50 for a year's subscription, we have the tools to help you discover what you really want from life. Visit moretolifemag.co.uk to find out more about us. Exploration is the path to a better life.
The Crystal Sound Bowl Experience. Relax in private surroundings close to Glastonbury Town Centre and benefit from the powerful energies created by Crystal Sound Bowls. Experience deep relaxation, boost the immune system and release tension at a very deep level. The soothing yet stimulating sounds resonate with the chakras, helping the body to be in its natural state, peaceful and at ease. For discussions, consultations and appointments, please telephone Steve Dash on 07768 252323 or email steve-at-hotmail.co.uk. The Crystal Sound Bowl Experience.
The Connections Magazine, the leading independent free guides to personal development, natural therapies and all things mystic. The three regional magazines cover the Southwest, London and Southeast and the Midlands, with articles and columns by Dr. Alan Sweeney, Barbara Brennan, Dr. Keith Hearn, Joseph Sarah, Karen Kay, Gail Force and many more. Why not advertise from only £230 a year? Your events, therapies, centres, courses and workshops, retreats, readings, products for sale, organic and vegetarian shops. With us to our thousands of like-minded readers. See theconnections.co.uk or phone 01747 823 424. Hurry, time is ticking. Whether it's for fitness, for fun, or for the family, Avalon Leisure Centres have something for everyone. Visit us now at Froome Leisure Centre, Wells Leisure Centre, and Strode Swimming Pool and Fitness Centre in Street. Visit our website for details at avalonleisure.co.uk or call now for great savings on our lifestyle membership scheme on 01458 444915. Quoting GlastonburyRadio.net. That's 01458 444915. In 1971, US President Nixon declared a war on cancer. 30 plus years later, it continues, taking the lives of loved ones and consuming billions in currency all over the world. Why is that, one must ask? A prudent question, as 15 plus cultures around the planet remain free of this and other diseases that are rife in the modern world. What are the factors in their lives that enable this to be? Well, actually, the answers have been known for a very, very long time. For further information, visit apricotshop.co.uk, whose mission is researching, providing information and supplying carefully selected products that potentially provide protection for people's health, along with reducing the risk of contracting lifestyle-related diseases. Put you and your family's well-being first. Prevention is undoubtedly the key to a vibrant existence.
Hi, this is your own pal, Ozzy Osbourne. I love listening to Ross Hemsworth and his guests on Now That's Weird. They make me feel f***ing normal.
Yeah, you're back with me, Ross Hemsworth, through till midnight. Still to come, Neil Hudson-Newman in Hour 3, Mike Oram in Hour 2, and Andrew Collins with us in this hour. And just before we go back to Andrew, got an email in about the Large Hadron Collider. It says, hey Ross, hi Penny, an idea Ross, you mentioned the idea that someone or something may have stopped the Hadron Collider from working. I personally think it's just going badly due to the poor work and rush jobs they're doing on it. I mean, if there was someone out there that was trying to help us or save us, probably from ourselves, you'd think they would do so much more, like stop us from creating nuclear waste, endless pollution and so on. If there was someone out there who cared so much about us, they would let us get past the first starting bits, not wait to the last minute to stop it. All the alien books I've read have said they are not here to save us, so why stop the collider? And that's from Pam, one of our regular listeners in Alaska. Good point, Pam. It was just a thought. When we start the show in the evenings, we like to give you some food for thought, some subjects for discussion. And someone mentioned to me on, I think it was Facebook or MySpace the other day, why is it the Large Hadron Collider keeps going wrong. Is there an outside force maybe intervening to stop it? Well, I don't know, so I'm throwing it over to you lot. And that's Pam's views on it. If you've got a view, same address, ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk. Now, before the break, we were talking to Andrew Collins. We had to interrupt him in his prime. Andrew, if you'd like to carry on from where you left off for me.
Okay. Well, I think that we're looking at some kind of secret chamber or hidden chamber in the depths of Giza's cave underworld. Certainly that would be, you know, a good thing to assume might be down there. But of course, obviously other people believe that it's the site of the Hall of Records. Now, the Hall of Records was an idea that America's most famous psychic Edgar Cayce came up with as early as 1924, when he predicted that somewhere in the vicinity of the Sphinx underground was something called the Hall of Records, and that in here was the life records of all those that had sort of lived in Egypt in a bygone age, and that some of them were actually sort of written down in stone. It was almost like a book of life in stone, in a sense. Now, although I personally don't feel that something like that is going to be discovered down there, what I think that he was getting onto was this idea of almost like a womb chamber of creation, where all life comes from, you know, all life returns in death, because it was seen as like the point of creation of the universe, the point of creation of the physical world, so that everything comes from that, everything will return to that, so all life experiences come from it and return to it. That's what I think that Edgar Cayce was picking up on. And I try and sort of do these ideas justice in the book Beneath the Pyramids, which, you know, brings out all of these ideas in a much greater detail.
Now, it is interesting because a few people on the forums, as you say, are criticising the fact that you've got a book coming out, therefore that's what this is all about. Now, I know you better than that, and I know that your research has always been very thorough, but what reassurances can you give to the listeners that this is about something more than just a book?
Well, I mean, firstly, I think it's important to remember that I am a writer. That is my trade, for my sins, that's what I do. So, you know, everything I do ends up in a book one way or another. And also publishers do like you to promote what they actually bring out. But beyond that is something that's fast becoming even bigger than the book itself. And that is the fact, you know, that have we made a huge discovery, or is this just some kind of, you know, publicity stunt? And suddenly we've had to go into serious mode. And myself and Nigel Skinner-Simpson have spent a lot of time over the last few days, particularly since Zoe Hawass's posts dismissing our cave discoveries, or what he calls Collins Caves, which I find quite amusing. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we've had to meticulously and studiously go back and try and, you know, answer all queries on blogs and forums, message boards, all the rest of it, as scholarly as we possibly can. So the reason why for me taking down the YouTube file was probably now been justified, because if it was still up there, we would still get the bad flack from that. And people would not now be listening, because it's important now to gain a proper foundation point for what we've discovered, and then everything will follow suit afterwards.
Absolutely. Now, how did you get through Hawass in the first place to get out there and explore this area?
Well, we didn't need to, because, you know, we entered the plateau as tourists, and once you buy a ticket for what they call the Pyramids area, technically, and I've been told this by officials, that you can go more or less anywhere on the plateau above ground. So, you know, we did nothing wrong by being where we were. I mean, in all honesty, you know, we encountered a few officials that we had to talk to try and get where we wanted. But we were acting purely as tourists. We went into the site as tourists, and that's it, for observational purposes. We weren't there to do any kind of of exploration that would have involved, you know, digging things up or anything more than that. So, you know, that's the way that I approach it. I mean, clearly now there's a lot of interest in this site. We want to do it properly now. I don't even believe that we could do now what we did just over a year ago and basically just walk in there. I understand that the security over there has been beefed up completely over the last few months, and that you know, you just wouldn't get anywhere near it now, which is fair enough, because hopefully it will preserve the very delicate ecosystem down there, which involves not just colonies of bats but spiders, you know, possibly a venomous species which we identified, and obviously all the bugs and insects that they live on, and of course the untouched archaeology that's down there. You know, we want to try and preserve this, or we want the Egyptian authorities to preserve it. And in April I sat in front of Zohi Hawass and, you know, I implored him to do something about this before, you know, the book came out, or before this story broke, you know, broke the news.
Mm.
Now, he did say that he would do something about it.
Now, the whole thing with the bats has got another side to it as well, isn't it? Because halfway through the video that was up on YouTube, you suddenly jump and yell. Now, tell us the story behind what happened with
that. Well, what happens is that, you know, the bats tend to come out in groups as they fly through the cave tunnel. And you can actually tell when this is happening because there's like this sort of waft of warm wind that comes, and you know what's approaching. It's almost like a wave. So at that point you get down. The only trouble is, on one occasion I got up too quickly and a bat hit me straight in the face and knocked me flying. So luckily I was unhurt and lived it. But I actually had the camcorder with me at that moment, so it recorded the whole thing.
Okay, let's go to the emails. First one comes in from Alan in Swindon, who says, do you think Hawass has any agenda to stop certain people from finding new discoveries?
I don't think so. I just think they like to do it in an ordered fashion. You know, in other words, if you are not academic, you know, you won't be invited to try and find anything. And I'm not an academic, I'm not a scholar. I came out of school at the age of 16 with no qualifications whatsoever. I eventually became a writer, and I've had a pretty successful career at that. But I'm an inquisitive bugger as well, and I want to know things, and I want to find things out. I don't just do armchair research. Sorry if I swore on your radio program.
That's all right, I do it all the time.
And but, you know, I need to find things out. You know, if I get a bee in my bonnet, I want to just go over there and check it out. And I've been doing this for years now. I've been to Cuba looking for Atlantis. I've been to Jordan looking for the Mountain of God. You know, I've been inside, you know, tunnels created by the Nazis in France in the Second World War looking for artifacts and things like this. You know, that's what I do. If I believe there's something there, you know, I won't stop until I get answers.
Well, I have to say to the listeners, when Andrew came round the other night to do the video, which will be going up shortly on YouTube, he did look like the Indiana Jones figures that he's been described as. So there you go. Right, now, next email says, hi Ross, Penny, Andrew, and of course Lulu the cat. Thank you for that. I have some time wondered about Hawass and his agenda. There you go, another one saying the same thing. Fact is, Ross, worldwide it is usually amateurs that discover ancient sites. Think of Sutton Hoo and its amateur discoverer. In fact, if it were not for amateurs finding sites, there would be no archaeologists. Discovery of ancient sites happened before archaeology even existed. I guess they are protecting jobs for the boys, etc., and I could see there could be concern that amateurs would wreck and ruin a site and its archaeological context. However, if they start kicking amateurs off discoveries, I would wager amateurs will stop reporting their finds. It could just be how Hawass is feeling stupid that a foreigner, inverted commas, found something on his patch. Yet again, Egyptian history discovered by pink-skinned people, laugh out loud. Also, I do wonder if he considers his version of Egyptian history as the version, with no room for debate or discussion. If he dictates who can find what, can he not dictate what is found and therefore control Egyptian history? Take care. And that's from Gary. What do you make of that, Andrew?
Yeah, thank you. It's just really difficult. I think he's in a really difficult position as well. You know, I mean, he retires next year, and he has to continue always to be in a position of strength and control. So he was never going to acknowledge that we found a cave underworld. It just was never going to happen. And I'm afraid that this is not unusual to archaeology. I mean, often in other parts in this country, I mean, a friend of mine, you know, wrote to me in the last couple of weeks, and he said, what happens when amateurs discover something is that the archaeological world will ignore it. And then about 2 years later, suddenly, they will have found it. and that's exactly what will occur. I doubt that. I mean, I'm actually surprised that Zohi Hawass actually commented about that, because in a way, the best thing he could possibly have done is nothing, and then it would have probably all gone away, and that's it. But he's ignited a debate now where, in all honesty, he's come off the loser. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's only got himself to blame for this. And the problem is that there was a lot of mistruths in what he said, and people have picked up on that and have seen right the way through what he's done here.
Absolutely.
I think it's a shame because, you know, he's a likeable man. I think he's very funny, and I think he's good for Egyptology. You know, I sat in front of him in April. We told him all about that. We gave him a report of our discoveries and everything that led to them, so he knew full well what had been discovered back in April.
Well, I think this last email I'm going to read out here from Jed in New Jersey sums it all up. He just says, congratulations, Andrew, you've got Hawass to name the cave system after you. You'll go down in history.
Well, I mean, you know, in all honesty, it wasn't just me. It was our colleague Nigel Skinner-Simpson. So, I mean, in all honesty, I'd be just quite happy with Tomb of the Birds, really. You know, and from the point of view of the caves, the local, Egyptian Arab Guardian just called them El Kaf, which means, you know, the cave or the caves in Arabic. And he said that they were the caves of El Hanash. So, you know, if you got an Arabic name, it would be Kaf El Hanash, which the caves of El Hanash, the great serpent. So
fair enough.
I'd be quite happy with that.
Well, time's caught up on us, Andrew. Just very quickly, where can people get the book?
Try Amazon, probably the first place, but also look on andrewcollins.com. There is bucket loads of information and pictures of the cave system there. So, you know, and just watch this story. It's moving forward every week.
Absolutely. Well, as soon as we get the new video information from Andrew, we'll get it up on the Now That's Weird website, so keep an eye there. Andrew, a delight as always talking to you, and good luck.
Cheers. Thanks, Ross.
We'll catch up soon. Cheers.
See you then.
Bye-bye. Bye. There you go, Andrew Collins, and a breaking story. We try and get them here as quickly as we can on Now That's Weird, as they happen. And this happened this week, as I say. Andrew contacted me, said, Ross, could you interview me for a thing I'm doing for YouTube? He came down here with his own camera, and we did a quick interview, asking him the relevant questions, and that will be up on YouTube next week. As soon as it is, we'll get the embed code up on the Now That's Weird site, as I said, so you should be able to see that quite quickly. Now, going into hour two tonight, we're going to be talking to Mike Oram. Now, this was an interview I recorded last week, so it's a brand new interview with Mike. We recorded it live at Studio 2 while he was down in Glastonbury, but I will be around. I'll be in the chat room chatting while that's going out, and then I'm back live again in Hour 3 with Neil Hudson-Newman, who's going to be talking to us, amongst other things, about why that thermonuclear device that he predicted at 8 a.m. this morning didn't actually happen. We'll be talking about that in Hour 3. He's got a few more predictions, apparently, as well, so worth having a listen to that. So I'm back live at 11, 10 through to 11, as I say, a recorded interview, but only done last week, so still new. I just got an email in saying, could I give that web address again? It's andrewcollins.com. That's andrewcollins.com. Do check it out.
listens to on a Friday night.
This is Now That's Weird
with Ross Hemsworth.
Zoink, Scoob! I smell something weird!
It's not weird. It's Ross Hemsworth.
You're listening to Now That's Weird with Ross Hemsworth.
Are you truly happy? Do you feel that there's more to life, but don't know where to find it? More to Life magazine is the spiritual magazine to enlighten you with simple, easy-to-read articles on everything from angels, stress management and healing, through to Reiki, yoga and meditation. For just £13.50 for a year's subscription, we have the tools to help you discover what you really want from life. Visit moretolifemag.co.uk to find out more about us. Exploration is the path to a better life. Visit the show's official website, nowthatsweird.co.uk, and meet the team behind the show. For nearly 20 years, Nexus has been the world's leading alternative news magazine. Read a selection of articles at nexusmagazine.com. Published every 2 months, Nexus is your best source of hard-to-get information behind the news, health, UFOs, future science. If you don't believe everything your government and their experts tell you is true, where do you look instead? Phone Nexus Magazine today on 01342 322 854 or see nexusmagazine.com. Available at all good news agents.
Hi, this is your own pal, Ozzy Osbourne. I love listening to Ross Hemsworth and his guests on Now That's Weird. They make me feel f***ing normal.
Let the children do that.
there is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space itself and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area that we call... Now that's weird.
Well, welcome back to Hour 2 of Now That's Weird. It's Friday night. You're listening to me, Ross Hemsworth, and my guest in Hour 2 is Mike Oram. Mike, welcome to the programme.
Thanks a lot, Ross.
Now, I need you to come a little bit closer to the mic, because you're sounding just a little bit ambient, but Mike's live with us in the studio right now, rather than being at the end of a phone, which is always nice. Many of you will remember we have spoken to Mike on the show before, but for many of the new listeners, Mike, let's put them in the picture. Give us a bit of background about how you got involved in all this strange phenomena that we all seem to be encountering right now.
Yeah, right. In a nutshell, it is a long story. It started when I was 4 years old. As you know, in 1955, I had a conversation with my mother where I explained to her that there was no such thing as death. And then I went on to tell her they weren't my real parents. And she was very shocked and said, I was born in this house. And I said, well, you're my parents as far as bringing me onto this earth. That my real parents are in space. But then I went on to say to her that something of incredible importance was going to happen on this planet, and it would affect all units of consciousness, whether it was mineral, vegetable, animal or man. I said, not in your lifetime, Mum, but in mine. Now, I was seeing this like in, I suppose you would say, my third eye region. I was having very powerful visual images, and words seemed to be there for those images, which is how I was able to tell my mother at 4 years old. This went on to very shortly after that, I started to meet my space brother, whose name is Telosh, pronounced Telosh, but it's spelled T-E-L-L-O-S. It's a name that he gives me because I think we need names when we're here in 3D. He's appeared to me throughout my life. And the main message of our meetings is to do with this shift of consciousness. So that's really it in a nutshell. In between all those years, I've had many, many sightings of craft, and I've been on craft. I'm told in my mind to go somewhere at a certain time. Could be the middle of the night. Might drive in my car. Might look out a certain window. Might open a certain door. And there the light or the craft would be. That's it in a nutshell.
Now, this must have been quite stunning for your mother at 4 years old for you to be coming out with all of this information.
It had a powerful impact on my mother, and so much so, I mean, she died 15 years ago, but so much so that she continued to bring up this conversation that we had at that time in 1955, especially the bit about the change of consciousness. And I always felt there was more to my mum than she told me. And throughout my life spent with her until she passed away or moved on, I used to say to her, you know who I am, don't you? You know why I'm here. And she always used to end by saying, well, I'm the seventh child of a seventh child. And she would end it there. Mm. She would never say any more.
Now, what about your father? How did your father take all of this?
And my dad was a different story. He was very down to earth, which, you know, it was understandable. He was born in 1912 and, you know, he'd had a hard life. He'd gone through the 30s depression and then he was sort of off to war and, you know, there wasn't much money around. I mean, he was really stuck here in 3D, really. And it was a hard life when I was a child. You know, there wasn't, you know, much money. You know, there was no such thing as like carpets on the floor or hot running water or indoor toilets. You know, it was a very hard life. I'm making that point because, you know, this is the angle I come at with my dad. It was very hard to survive, and I think his mind therefore was very much directed to down here in 3D, and he didn't really have the time, I don't think, to think of what was going on out there in space. So in 1970, I'd had an amazing week where I'd gone to Warminster, in fact, and craft came every single night. There was a landing. I met my space brother. Lights would appear and they would answer our torch as we flashed our torch at them. It was just an amazing week. And I drove back home to sort of London, Essex, where we were at the time. And burst through the front door about midnight and they were sitting up waiting for me. And I just sort of told them this entire week's activity down in Warminster, and Mum would always listen eagerly to what I had to say, but Dad used to just give a strange sort of smile, you know. I could tell he was looking at me thinking, you know, what has happened to my son? This affected me so much at that time that I sat in meditation on and off for a couple of weeks, asking for them to come. Now, I was in contact with them telepathically, and I thought, well, they tell me to go to other places to meet them, so why can't I ask them to come here for my dad? And eventually, after a couple of weeks of meditation, I was told to go and look out of my parents' bedroom window. And I went and looked out of the window, and hovering above the house was this huge, like silver sphere. And it was almost like it was alive, because there seemed to be particles of silver sort of just flitting off the edges of it. And I went downstairs, Dad was sitting in the armchair, and I just calmly said to him, would you like to see, although I said one of those flying saucers, Dad, it wasn't actually a typical flying saucer. And he just sort of almost tongue in cheek said, yes, I wouldn't mind, son. And so I said to him, well, go and open the front door and have a look. And he stepped outside and looked up, and he got incredibly excited, which my dad never done. He asked for the binoculars, and I ran upstairs and got my binoculars, and there he was looking at this object in the sky through the binoculars. And I felt really proud at that moment, and I was just thinking in my mind, you know, my dad is looking at this craft. And then I thought, well, it's waiting for quite a while in a built-up area, possibly 2 to 3 minutes. And I got this telepathic message which said to me, if they went away too quickly, then my dad would go inside and sit down and find some way to explain it away. And they said by waiting for that amount of time, they said he would fully take into his consciousness what he was seeing, and he would never forget it. The experience goes on because the craft moved away, but again, to sort of cut the story short, he died about 10 years ago. And he never really mentioned this experience. And of course, I carried on having mine and would tell my parents about it, but he didn't really listen. But when he was in a hospice, and I travelled over to see him, and I sat with him for about 3 hours. He'd been senile for quite a while, but he could still talk about the war. But on this particular day, he couldn't. He couldn't talk about anything. And you could see that he was not far away really from passing over. His face was white and pasty, and his face was sunken. And I sat with him for 3 hours, and then no conversation whatsoever. And then I said to him, well, Dad, I have to go now. I've got to get my train. And I got up to leave the room, and then he just said, do you remember that light? And I turned around and said, what light, Dad? And he said, the light that came and hovered over our house. And I said, do you remember that then? And he said, yes. So I came in and sat back down, and I said, well, tell me about it. And he did. And this is the most wonderful thing, because he told me the entire experience. He hadn't forgot one moment. And the next morning, he was dead. So that was actually the last conversation I had with my dad. So I think that experience had, like they said, gone fully into his consciousness, and he had never forgot it.
It's amazing. Now, you've had other experiences at home, and after the break we're going to be talking about one that you had in America, but let's come back first of all to home again, and the experience with the golden horn that you spoke about at a conference recently.
The golden funnel, yes, it came, this golden funnel came through the window in the middle of the night. Never seen it before. I was a bit surprised. But out of this funnel came numbers and letters and symbols, and they danced around the top of the room. But also out of this funnel came two beings of pure golden light. I called them the light beings simply because of that. They then hovered over my body, and they merged into my body. And as soon as they merged into my body, there was this amazing amount of energy that almost took my breath away. And then I saw this incredible white light, and I knew I had to go into this light. I had no choice. For that moment in time, I actually felt I was not worthy to go into such a place. But into the light I did go, and as soon as I entered the light, I went into what I can only say is was complete and utter oneness. And in this sort of the state of mind or whatever, there simply was no separation. At this level, there was no separation. It was all total oneness. There was no inside, no outside. It was like I was the universe and the universe was me. And if that was not amazing enough, I started to become aware of something else. There was even something else that was behind this complete oneness, and it was quite simply love. And I mean love like with a capital L. And it showed me that everything that comes into existence originally comes from love. They then told me that these numbers and letters and symbols were going to go into my mind, and at some future point the understanding would be released to me, either by them or by my higher self. Now, some years later, I come across a couple of books by Dolores Cannon, and she's really world famous, constantly travels around. She's regressed well over 1,000 people like myself. She's the author of several books, but in these two books, and this was some years later, she mentions in those books that she's come across too many times to be coincidence, a golden funnel that either comes through the window or comes down from the sky, and out of that funnel come numbers and letters and symbols that go into the person's mind, and the knowledge is going to be released in the near future. So something is definitely going on here.
Now there's a link back to Egypt, isn't there, with this golden funnel I remember you talking about in the conference.
Yes, it was to do with the it was an initiatory experience that Fran, my partner, had found on the internet when she was researching this about the golden funnel. And it was to do with the Hermes Mystery School. And they called it a torus. It was a type of funnel, but they said that a part of the initiatory experience was out of this torus came numbers and letters and symbols, which went into the person's mind. So whether it is some sort of initiatory experience or not, I do not know. But it's wonderful getting this confirmation, you know, because we're dealing with things here that I suppose are not in the normal fabric of our life here in 3D. And I always, you know, really appreciate getting confirmation from other places.
I think that's the hardest part for all of us, isn't it? Is getting the confirmation of the things we believe. There's so many things happen to us all, and we then do exactly what you thought your father would do, go and find the rational and logical explanation for what's happened and rule it out. We'll be back talking some more with Mike Oram right after this.
The proposition is straightforward. We install digital posters at any location on your premises and then stream any information you require remotely to your high-definition screens. The concept is called digital signage. And In Your Face Media is the leading business providing this technology. In Your Face Media is a young, enthusiastic company with the expertise and infrastructure to get your message across. We offer fast, interactive, animated and video marketing communication on high-definition screens in conjunction with remote media and their award-winning Signage Live software. We've installed a large number of HD digital screens in a wide variety of environments. If you're as excited with digital signage as we are, then please call us. We'd be more than happy to arrange a meeting and discuss your needs and our solutions in greater detail on 0117 942 0670, or visit our website at inyourfacemedia.co.uk.
The Hex family has been making traditional farmhouse cider in Somerset for six generations, since 1840. Using apples grown in our orchards upon Glastonbury Tour, our ciders and perry are still made the traditional way, using wooden barrels and sold straight from the wood. Try our port wine of Glastonbury, now on draft at the George and Pilgrims Hotel in Glastonbury. Or better still, visit our cider farm at 9 to 11 Middle Lee Inn Street, just 2 miles from Glastonbury Town Centre, and taste our award-winning cider. bitters, perry and apple juice. As well as traditional blends, we have many single varieties like Kingston Black, cider vinegar, local cheddar cheese, jams, pickles, chutneys, marmalade, honey, Somerset Royal Cider Brandy, and a range of cider jars and mugs, all produced locally from farms around the Somerset Levels. So come and visit us today for a real taste of Somerset. Visit hexfarmhousecider.co.uk or call us on 01458 442 367. We welcome group tours, but don't come all at once, will you? Don't forget, that's hexfarmhousecider.co.uk.
Friday nights will never be the same again. Get hooked on Now That's Weird with Ross Hemsworth every Friday night at 9 p.m. GMT.
Okay, welcome back to Now That's Weird with me, Ross Hemsworth. My guest in this hour is Mike Oram. And Mike, we were talking about the conference quite recently. In the last couple of weeks, there's been a conference over at Warminster, of all places, where you had some of your first experiences with UFOs and the like. And it must have been quite something for you to return there and actually be speaking at a conference at a place that had so many memories for you.
Yes, it was. I mean, this was absolutely amazing. And before I answer that question, I must just say, Ross, it's great to be here talking to you in Glastonbury. I mean, our paths have crossed so many times now. We gave a talk over the telephone lines when I was living in my home in the Lake District. We had an interview at the Laughlin UFO Conference in Nevada. We had another interview at the UFO Conference in Southern Ireland last year. And there we are in Glastonbury. It's brilliant. But going back to Warminster, Warminster had and always had a special place in my heart, and the memories that I have of Warminster I deeply cherish, and they are still very much alive inside me today. I mean, I went to Warminster in 1969. That was my first visit, and I used to sometimes go down almost every weekend. I would leave Friday night and then come back home Sunday evening. Eventually moved down there in 1978 and I stayed till 1983. Met hundreds of wonderful people, but had the most amazing experiences. And I'd just like to say here that Warminster has always had a good press and a bad press. But there's a... Believe me, you know, the experiences that I had, for whatever people say, and we do have to take into account, you know, there would have been misrepresentations and some of it would have been connected to the military, but some of the things that I saw and experienced were not of Earth origin. And most people in those days used to go up on Cradle Hill, and on a good Saturday night, you could see well over 100 people, you know, and on special weekends, there could be over 200 people. And although I used to go up on Cradle Hill, I always preferred to go to Star Hill, what they used to say, called the barn, down at Star Hill. In those days, very few people went to Star Hill, and you could more often than not find yourselves alone. There was no light pollution then whatsoever. And on a clear night, it was just a wonderful place to be, and I had so many amazing experiences at Star Hill.
Mm. Now, during the weekend of the Weirdo 9 conference in Warminster a couple of weeks ago, they actually did a UFO watch on Cradle Hill. You went along to that, and they actually did see something that so far hasn't been rationally explained, didn't they?
They did see something, Ross, and I was supposed to have been up on Cradle Hill. However, I was with some friends, and we'd gone for a meal at Corton, and I'd told them about my early years in Star Hill, and they were hoping to see my space brother, and there was a good chance of seeing him down at Star Hill. Unfortunately, we ran out of time, and I didn't go up on Cradle Hill. We went out to Star Hill. Now, I did hear the next morning that they had seen something, but I do not know a great deal about what happened.
And you were quite friendly with Arthur Shuttleworth back in the Warminster earlier days as well, weren't you?
Arthur was, as I said about Warminster, you know, having a good press and a bad press, Arthur Shuttleworth also had a good and bad press. And, you know, sometimes so many awful things were said about him, it did affect his health. And in a way, I mean, he was a very dear and close friend of mine, but I would be the first to admit that he did make mistakes. I mean, we all make mistakes. But as I said at the conference, I used to go up on that hill at Cradle Hill, you know, say in the winter time, sometimes in the most appalling weather. I mean, something I wouldn't do today. I mean, I was a lot younger then, but I would sort of make my way to the top, and it would be, you know, wind and cold, rain, and as I approached the top of the hill, you could almost guarantee that Arthur would be standing up there, you know, sort of huddled with his hands in his pockets. And for all the mistakes that he made, he was a searcher. As he wrote in my book, when he dedicated one of the books to me, he was a searcher for cosmic truths. He would not have put that time in those conditions if he wasn't trying to find out what was going on. But I often stood with him on top of Cradle Hill in such conditions, and we used to share each other's experiences. And there was a lot of things that happened to Arthur on those hills when he was up there on his own that he has never put in his books. And, you know, sadly, as he is no longer with us, this is something that will remain inside my head.
Now, there was a guy last year or year before, Professor John Searle, who came forward and said that he was responsible for all the UFO sightings over Warminster when he was testing out his flying disc anti-gravity vehicle. Now this is something that's been taken, I suppose, two completely different ways by the believers and non-believers. Some were saying, oh, well, that explains Warminster, then it was all that, and that's the bottom line. Those that were there, like yourself, know that it was more than that. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct. But, you know as well as me, Ross, there's always people like this. I mean, it's very similar to Chaz and Dave creating all the crop circles. If you want to believe that, then that is your journey. You know, too many people are just too blind. They have these things made up in their minds, and it doesn't take much to convince them otherwise. I mean, it's complete and utter nonsense to say that, like it is with Chaz and Dave creating, or not Chaz and Dave. It's not Chaz and Dave. Chaz and Dave are the singers.
They're the singers, yeah. I'm trying to think of the names themselves.
It's Dave, isn't it?
Yeah. Was it Bob and Dave?
No, it's not Bob and Dave. One of the listeners will tell us, yeah. Yes. Perhaps Chaz and Dave helped as well, I don't know. But,
yeah, maybe.
What I find amazing, you know, with this sort of thing is that it's more difficult to believe, you know, that, say, these two men created the crop circles, or so with his machines was responsible for all the UFO activity, than what it is to believe that perhaps something else was going on as well. That's what I find quite difficult. I mean, I've dealt with that type of mind all my life, and I find as I get older, when I was younger, I think I was a lot more feisty. You know, I would talk to anybody, I would try to convince anybody. I was always happy to talk to reporters. You always got set up in these articles, and I would just bounce back and do the same thing again. These days, I can't be bothered to fight anymore. You know, we are in really important times now, and it's no more a game to play. This is very important for humanity, and if people still have closed minds, I'm afraid for me, after 40 years, there's no more I can do about that. I can talk at these conferences, but a lot of the time you're talking to the converted. But when you step out of that circle, and then you try and talk to not just the ordinary people, say, down your street, but even people that have known you for 20 to 30 years, you still cannot get them to open their mind to look at anything outside of this so-called reality.
That's exactly right. And unfortunately, science runs on a thing, as you probably know, called Occam's Razor, where there are multiple explanations. The simplest is usually the best. And the simplest isn't always the best. The simplest isn't always right. And that's where I think science goes wrong with these sort of things.
Yes, I think with UFOs, I mean, it's much more complex. You know, I mean, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with perhaps beings coming here from other physical planets, beings coming from other dimensions, other frequencies. They may be coming here for different reasons. I'm sure there are some coming here purely for observation because of what is going on this planet at the time. And then there are people like my space brother who are here to give us the knowledge as to what is going on this planet, especially with these consciousness changes, which is what I was aware of.
Absolutely.
Back in 1955.
Now let's go on to Nevada. A few years ago you went out to Nevada and some very strange things happened to you. Talk us through exactly what happened.
Yeah, I don't know how long we've got here, Ross, because it's two whole chapters in the book.
We've got to try and get it into about 12 to 15 minutes.
Right, okay. So shall I just fire away?
Edited version, I think. Yeah,
the edited version. Okay. Yes, it was 2004. We'd planned to have a trip out to Area 51 and to a place called Rachel, which some of the listeners will be aware of, where there is the little alien cafe. It was about 240 miles from Laughlin, from the conference, and I'd hired a car, a Mitsubishi Outlander, and we left the hotel at about 8:15 in the morning. We skirted around Las Vegas, and we made our way up on Highway 93, and our first stop was Alamo. This was a good two-thirds of the journey, so we had, you know, initially we had a good run. We stopped at Alamo, really to have a coffee and a donut. There was just like a shop which incorporated a cafe and a garage and a couple of houses. Now I think we were there about 11:45 in the morning, something 11:50, and we left there about 12:15. From there it was about 24 miles, I'm not getting these figures exactly, but they're roughly about 24 miles, to what they call the Groom Lake Road. Now the Groom Lake Road is a dirt road that drives down for 14 miles till you come to the boundary line of Area 51. So now you have to go up on what they call Highway 375, and that is officially known now as Extraterrestrial Highway. It is almost 6,000 feet above sea level, you know, so you're talking of 1.5 times almost the height of Ben Nevis. It's a very desolate place. And it actually, we picked up a brochure in the local agency, and it was an official brochure on Extraterrestrial Highway given out by their tourist board, and it said inside that if a dozen cars traverse this highway in one day, then they would say that was rush hour traffic. That is how isolated it was. We eventually got onto the Groom Lake Road. As I said, we drove the 14 miles down and we stopped at the boundary. It's an imaginary line. There are some signs up. One of them's quite famous, you know, which says that you can't take any photos or even make graphic representations, etc., 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 at or standing over this area. Use of deadly force authorized. There were two cameras on poles to the left looking down at us, and just to the right was a military truck with two, what I say, like camo looking dudes in, also looking down at us. It was a very intimidating place. You're there on your own. Anything could happen to you and nobody would know where you'd gone to. Fran stayed in the car. I went back to the car and I said to Fran, look, we've not come all this way not to at least take one photo. I wanted to take photos of the camera and the men in the truck, but felt uneasy. I took this one photo. I said to Fran, I'll take one photo of this sign. I said, do a quick 3-point turn, hit the gas pedal, zoom back up to the main road, and then we'd drive along to Rachel and Little Ailey Inn. So that's what I'd done. Turned the car around, hit the gas pedal, driving back up Groom Lake Road. Now at this point, you have to realise it's absolute flat open desert. We were very quickly followed by a military truck. Whether it's the same one or not, we do not know. I saw it in the rearview mirror, mentioned it to Fran, and Fran said yes, she could see it in the wing mirror. Gone about another 200 yards, I said to Fran, it's even closer, when all of a sudden there was this sound. Fran shouted out, what was that? She said, it sounds like we've been shot. Now, I stopped the car in 10 seconds. I was out of the car in just a few more seconds, and that truck was nowhere to be seen, and that just really surprised us. Where had that truck gone? I looked down. The tire had exploded in one spot. It did look like it had been shot by something. The next strange thing was that I decided not to change the tyre there. This came out later under regression. We probably won't have time to go through that. But I decided to drive 6 miles to this known as Medlin Ranch. It's just like this very small complex that is with padlocked gates and metal fencing. I drove 6 miles and ripped the rest of the tyre to shreds. I started to change the wheel there, put the new tyre on, which is known in America as a donut tyre. You know, you don't get a proper spare wheel now. In this country, it's an emergency tyre. The Mitsubishi tyres were wide. This was half its width. It had almost smooth surface, very little tread depth. In the handbook, it said not to drive very far, not to drive over 50 miles an hour, so I was concerned about driving on it. There were two more nuts to do up. I asked Fran to do the last two up as my back was aching, and all of a sudden this truck appeared, another truck, a different truck. This was another anomaly because we never saw it arrive. We talked about this. It was just there in front of us. Two men got out looking like ranchers. One of them was about 6'2". One was about, he was slim. One was about 5'9", 5'10". He was stockier. And it was a little boy who was about 10 years old. All this little boy done was stared across at Fran the whole time. The tall, slim man just said, "Looks like we've arrived too late." I thought, as naturally, he meant about helping to change the tyre, but under regression, it had a totally different meaning. He then said, "What do you think of our weather?" I said to him, "Well, it's much the same as in England now. We're both coming out of our winters." But that's all he said. "Looks like we've arrived too late. What do you think of our weather?" The stockier man then leant forward and he said, "Let me help you with that, ma'am." And he picked up the damaged tyre and put it in the back of our car. And then he came back to his original place about 8 foot in front of us. I then asked him if they knew where we could get a new tyre. They said we could drive into Rachel, there's a man there, but he won't have one of these tyres. He said, "You're better off driving to Alamo." We asked him the best direction, and he gave us the opposite direction. So he had actually sent us closer to Rachel than we were now to Alamo. The time was getting on. Now, this is where we lost the 2 hours, because we arrived at this boundary line at the end of the Groom Lake Road at 1:15, took the photos. We left at 1:25, and we got the puncture about 5 minutes later, so it was about 1:30. It took us about 20 minutes to get to Medlin Ranch, driving on this punctured tyre. It was about 6 miles. So when we arrived at Medlin Ranch, it should have been 1:50. And when we arrived at Medlin Ranch, I said to Fran, "Look, it's getting dark. We've got to get this tyre changed. It's 4:10. Now, we had just lost 2 hours in time. Now, I've studied this subject for 40 years. Fran has studied this subject for 30 years. When we have interviewed people that have had experiences, as anybody knows in this subject, the first thing you're looking for is, was there any missing time? Now, this had just happened to us, and we were following the time as we were going along. We knew where the time was. We knew it was 1:30, and we knew it should have been 1:50 when we got there or thereabouts, and yet I said it was 1:40. We lost 2 hours, and we never noticed it. And I still find that quite amazing. We did not notice this missing time until 2 weeks later, when we got back in England and I'd got the photos developed, and we were sitting on the couch going through the photos. And when we got to this sequence, I said to Fran, "Well, hang on a minute, how could it have been 1:40 when we got to Medlin Ranch? It should have been 1:50 and that's when we realised that something had gone on, and we did look for a regression. And we did have a man that come and stayed at our home for 5 days and went through several experiences, and one of them was the missing time at Area 51. Another one was the light beings. But anyway, they eventually went, these people, these ranchers and the boy, and we drove on to Rachel. And we arrived in Rachel about 4:50 now. And the first building you come to is on the left-hand side, and it's called the Quick Pick Shop. And I went in there and asked the lady if I could use the phone to ring Hertz to hopefully get the car changed. I said it was a free phone number. She let us ring Hertz. They refused to bring another car out and said we had to drive to Las Vegas. I was very concerned about driving on this donut tire. In the end, I gave up and I said, okay, and I put the phone down. And the lady in the quick pick shop then said, you can't do that. And I said, why? She said, if you drive tonight and get a puncture on that donut tire, she said, no other cars will pass you. She said, it's so cold up here at night. She said, you can die up here at night. She said, I broke down 3 weeks ago in the daytime and sat by the road for 3 hours. And eventually a military truck come along and they helped her get her car started. She said, mobile phones don't work there, televisions don't work there, to which she blamed the military. So I said, look, if I ring back Hertz, will you explain this to them? We did ring back. And she agreed with them to get the car changed, and they said it would take them well over 6 hours, and they would arrive around midnight. But she then shut up her shop and she said, look, I'll get in my car, you follow me down to Little Ailey Inn and we'll get you booked in there. So we followed her down. She went up to the counter. There's a young lad behind the counter. We never saw him again, and he was looking through the booking in. She was looking through the booking in book. So I said to her, what, do you work here as well then? And she said, oh no, I just help out anybody. But then she was pointing in the book and she said, why have you put them in there? And the young lad said, I've been told to put them in there. She said, why can't they go in there? And he said, because I've been told they've got to go in there. Now, who has told this man? Because we'd all just arrived. She then got the key, and I stayed behind to pay the bill. She got the key and took Fran across to the mobile home. And Fran said, as they were walking across to the mobile home, this lady said to Fran, a stranger turned up 10 minutes before you. Now, I don't know when she was told this, because she'd never left our sight. But she said, a stranger turned up 10 minutes before you. We don't know who he is, but he is being put in the other half of your mobile home. She said, there's a room at each end, the bathroom's in the middle, and there's a connecting door each side to those bathroom, to that bathroom. She said, there's a padlock, a bolt on your door, your connecting door, and I suggest you keep it bolted. Anyway, we were a bit confused about this, but we had something to eat and bought some presents, and because TVs didn't work, there was a video player in the room and they had loads of videos that we could borrow, and we took a couple back and we started to settle down and wait for the Hertz to bring out the new vehicle, when this man, whoever he was, in the other half of our mobile home, kept coming out of his connecting door and standing in front of ours. After about 3 or 4 times of doing this, there was a large gap under the bottom of our door, and I said to Fran, have a look underneath the door, get down and have a look underneath the door. She did, and she said, yes, he's standing right outside. So I pulled the bolt open and opened the door, and he was literally outside our front door, facing our front door. And he also had a dog, and he spoke in a strange accent, and the closest I can get to it is that it sounded sort of like Polish. I spoke to him for a couple of minutes, but I cannot remember what I said. I even bent down and stroked the dog. Then I closed the door on him. And then at midnight, they brought the new Mitsubishi, went outside to change the paperwork. This man came out a couple more times afterwards, but we just ignored it. The driver of the low loader said, you made the right decision, he said, because for the last 160 miles, he said he had not passed one single car. He went. I came back inside. I then said to Fran, right, well, look, I'm going to try and get some sleep. So I was starting to get into bed, and Fran said a strange thing. She said, I'm not. She said, I'm going to lay on top of the bed, fully clothed and with my shoes on, ready for a quick exit. But we never discussed a quick exit from what. We weren't aware of the missing time. We knew there was a couple of odd things happened. But I never questioned this strange thing that she said. And I just said, okay, but I'm getting into bed. And I did. But I quickly woke up about 1 o'clock, and I was going to be sick, and it was imminent. I said to Fran, I'm going to be sick. I quickly got dressed. I opened the front door. It was a full moon, and it was very bright. There was like frost and some snow. I went down the 3 or 4 steps, and I thought, well, I can't be sick here, because we'll be stepping out here in the morning. So I run round to the back of the mobile home. At the end, there was a little window, and I thought that might be this person's bedroom window. And I thought, I can't start vomiting here, because he was like weird enough as it was. So I came back, and I stood at the side of the mobile home, and I started to be sick. I was sick 3 or 4 times. The first time I was being sick, I noticed above me was this huge white light. So I was being sick, looking up at the light, being sick, looking up at the light. When I finished being sick, this light moved off. I then run back round to the front of the mobile home, burst through the front door and said to Frank, quick, come and see this light before it goes. By now it was sort of nearing the horizon, and there was like some low mist and low cloud that it was going into, but Fran did see it. But then I turned to Fran and I said, well, you might have come out to see if I was okay. She said, what do you mean? She said, I sat on the bed for a good 10 minutes, you hadn't come back, so I went outside to look for you. I said, but I was round the back of the mobile home. She said, I went round the back, you weren't there. She said, I went round the car park, called out your name, you weren't there. She said, I even went to the front of Little Ailey Inn, and I called out your name. She said, you were nowhere to be seen. She said, I stood there and thought, I bet he's wandered off and his back's gone, and he's collapsed somewhere. She said, I thought, that's just the sort of thing he'll do. And then she said, God, I hope they haven't taken him. But she didn't know why she was saying that. She then gave up looking for me, went back into the mobile home. She went into the bathroom and she noticed some dry blood on her nose and thought she had bumped into a door. She then went back and sat on the edge of the bed, and she says she went into a sort of controlled panic. She thought, suppose he never comes back, I don't even drive. What am I supposed to do?
Well, let's hold it there, Mike, because we need to go to an ad break. But hold that thought, because we'll come back to this story right after the break.
Hi, this is your own pal, Ozzy Osbourne. I love listening to Ross Hemsworth and his guests on Now That's Weird. They make me feel f***ing normal.
Welcome back to Now That's Weird with me, Ross Hemsworth, and we're hearing from Mike Oram as what happened to him close to Area 51 in Rachel, Nevada. Mike, pick up from where you left off, if you would.
Right, so she was sitting on the edge of the bed, and she went into this controlled panic. She said she was there for at least another 10 minutes, so well over 30 minutes had passed. And then, she said, that's when I came bursting through the front door saying to look at this light. Now, as far as I was aware, I'd run out, I was sick round the back, and I ran back to tell Fran about the light. I couldn't have been out there more than 3, 4, 5 minutes at the absolute most. So something strange had gone on there. So I said to Fran, look, if we fall asleep, if one of us wakes up and it's light or it's starting to get light, we're loading up the car and we're going to drive back to Laughlin, even though Pat Travers, who owns Little Ailey Inn, had promised us a full breakfast in the morning. Well, sometime shortly after 4 o'clock, it was starting to get light, so we loaded up the car and we started back off down Extraterrestrial Highway. Now, as we were driving back down, we started to talk about the two ranchers that had that strange conversation with us. Looks like we've arrived too late. What do you think of our weather? We thought this conversation was strange, and we did discuss this. And then I said to Fran, yes, it was strange. It was odd. I said, but the little boy was even odder. And she said, what little boy? I said, the little boy that was with them. She said, there was no little boy. I said, yes, there was. And she said, what did he do? I said, he just stood there staring across to you the whole time. He never took his eyes off you. And I just thought in the end he may have been a bit shy. She said, well, how old was he? I said, about 10. She said, how did he leave? I said, he left with the two ranchers. They got back into this truck that we never saw arrive. She then said to me, look, I'm a trained nursery nurse. She said, don't you think I would see a 10-year-old boy standing 8 feet in front of me? And I said, well, yes, I would expect you to see him, but he was there. So this was another anomaly. This, for us at that time, was the major thing with this little boy. why did she not see him? Now, I do pick up on people's energy. I have done all my life. And his energy was strange. And I remember at the time thinking, I was trying to detect his, what energy this was. We then eventually got back to Laughlin. Of course, it was now Sunday, and it was time for the registration for the conference. It was a 9-day conference. So we registered. And I said to Fran, look, let's just go up to our room, have a quick shower, lay down for an hour, and then we'll come back and start to join in the festivities and look at the bookstores, etc. So we went up to our room. I said to Fran, you're going to have a shower first. Then very quickly she came running out. She said, look, look. And on the top of the inside of her leg were three long, thin fingerprint bruises. On her arm was this large red triangle that felt like sandpaper. And when I checked myself, above my right ankle were three red puncture wounds forming a triangle. Now, about a day and a half later, I started to be sick. It was a very strange sickness. Now, I didn't have a cold, didn't have a headache, upset tummy, fever, nothing. I actually felt quite fine, apart from this weird diarrhea and sickness. It was coming out of both ends. There was like a very fine brown powder and a strange white sort of liquid. And this went on for 2.5 days. I could not leave the room because it was so constant. I couldn't eat and I couldn't drink. It lasted with Fran for 1.5 days. When we eventually emerged out of our room and went back to the conference, several people said to us it sounded like some sort of detox. Now, we did find out later on under regression that it was a sort of detox for what had happened to us. So that's all the stuff that happened within our conscious mind. And when we got back home to England and realised we had this 2 hours of missing time, this is when we found somebody called David Coggins, who came up from South Wales to the Lake District, and he stayed for 5 days, and we looked into what had gone on.
Through regression.
Through the regression, yes.
Now tell us exactly what came out in the regression. Bear in mind, we've only got about 5 minutes. So
right.
Again, we need to condense this.
Oh, we'll have to condense this, yes, okay. Under regression, when we were chased by the truck where they shot at our tyre, and their truck had disappeared, when actually under regression, they had quickly surrounded the vehicle, our vehicle, before we could get out. They had like machine gun type weapons. When we were ordered out of our car, backed up to us was a truck that had a strange machine on the back that I at first said was a cannon. It looked like it had a wheel either side. There are drawings in my book showing this, but it was just on one side, and I said there were three different types of copper coil in those wheels. When Fran asked me under regression, what is this? I quite calmly said it was a magnetic pulse generator, and I said it could do all sorts of things, but one of the things it could do was create a portal. I said it was a portable portal maker. Now, Fran did look this up on the net and done some research. She even found a scientist in Russia who was working with one. We found out it does exist. It has a myriad of uses. This scientist emailed us back. His friend said to him, is it possible to create a portal? And he said, we're not far from it ourselves, and he believed it was possible. We had to go through the portal. We ended up in this underground base, and there were machines down there, all to do with consciousness. They knew I was a contactee. They wanted to know why I was there and who I was in contact with, and what had these people told me. But at some point, I was connected up to some machines. Fran started to struggle, and she was like subdued and forced onto this bed. I had these machines connected to my mind, trying to find out in my mind what I knew. But eventually there was another mind there that was not human, and this mind said that I had to be put back and no harm must come to me. Now, I've got to rush through this. I cannot do this justice now, but we were put back, and one of the military men had this little box on his waist, and it he done something to this box, and it sort of subdued me and Fran when once we were back inside the car, and it took us 10 minutes to come round. So when we got out of the car, it was 10 minutes and not just a few seconds, which is why we never saw the truck when we got back out. The two ranchers were not ranchers, and under regression there was no truck, which is why we never saw it arrive. This was done for our conscious mind. But what appeared under regression in its place was this huge white light, a globe of white light that was just sitting on the ground, or almost, and out of it walked my space brother Telosh with his friend Janap and this little boy. But he was not a little boy. He was a little alien. I'd never seen this type before. He was as orange as an orange. He was about the size of a 10-year-old child, and he had three stubby fingers. They told me that he was with them on a training mission, learning certain things, but one thing he could do was hold people in stasis. And that's why he was looking across to Fran, because I needed to communicate with my space brother, and this little being was holding Fran in stasis, and that's why she never saw the child. And again, to cut a long story short, when I was being sick, once I finished being sick, the light had not moved away instantly. A beam of light came out and lifted me up into the craft. And I was there for well over 30 minutes, again talking with Telosh. He told me I had to stop sticking my nose in where it doesn't belong, because he cannot be here to look after me all the time. He had saved my life a couple of times when I was younger, and he will come to me in points of emergency. This was an emergency, but he said by the time we found out you were being taken by the military, there was not enough time to come and stop this happening. And that's the reason why, he said, we drove to Medlin Ranch and ripped the rest of the tire to pieces, he said, because he needed to meet me and it was too dangerous on the Groom Lake Road.
Right, I'm going to stop you there, Mike, because we have run out of time. But if people want to know more about this story, they can get the book, can't they? The book is called Does It Rain in Other Dimensions? Where can they get that?
They can get it, well, they can order it from any good bookshop, or they can get it on Amazon, that's the best place, or they can get it through our website in otherdimensions.com.
And it is a book well worth reading, because it goes into far more depth than we've been able to fit into an hour here tonight. Now, what I would just say to you all is for UFO Congress 2010, as many of you know, we are doing a tour next year, which starts in Phoenix, goes up to Sedona, across to the Grand Canyon, up to Area 51, or as near as we can get, and then up to Rachel, Nevada. So all the places that Mike's spoken about, these strange experiences happening, you can actually be there and have a look for yourself next year in February. And if you want to go on that, just go to megalithictours.com. That website address again is www.megalithictours.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Glastonbury Radio, you clever little humanoids.
The show the world listens to on a Friday night.
This is Now That's Weird with Ross Hemsworth.
If you like to rock on ice, you'll love the Taliban on Broadway.
Bail me a lady tonight. Bail me a lady tonight. Bails on your eyes and ears and nose and heads and fingers, toes. So bail me a lady tonight.
Yes, the Taliban on Broadway. The most exciting play since Yasser Get Your Guns.
Holy war. Oh yes, it's gonna be a holy war. Because the USA will not go away. They declared a jihad every single day.
The Taliban on Broadway is filled with comedy.
If I were an Afghan, Bin Laden, 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 go.
Drama.
Saudi, he was once a rich Saudi.
And love.
Osama, I just met a boy named Osama. And suddenly I see what a terrorist he could be.
So hold your family hostage and go out and see The Taliban on Broadway, playing in theaters now or until the UN finds it.
I hate to live in Afghanistan, cover my face in Afghanistan.
Email the show, Ross, at nowthatsweird.co.uk.
Zoink, Scoob, I smell something weird.
It's not weird, it's Ross Hemsworth.
You're listening to Now That's Weird with Ross Hemsworth.
Are you truly happy? Do you feel that there's more to life, but don't know where to find it? More to Life magazine is the spiritual magazine to enlighten you with simple, easy-to-read articles on everything from angels, stress management and healing, through to Reiki, yoga and meditation. For just £13.50 for a year's subscription, we have the tools to help you discover what you really want from life. Visit moretolifemag.co.uk to find out more about us. Exploration is the path to a better life.
Visit the show's official website, nowthatsweird.co.uk, and meet the team behind the show. For nearly 20 years, Nexus has been the world's leading alternative news magazine. Read a selection of articles at nexusmagazine.com. Published every 2 months, Nexus is your best source of hard-to-get information behind the news, health, UFOs, future science. If you don't believe everything your government and their experts tell you is true, where do you look instead? Phone Nexus Magazine today on 01342 322 854 or see nexusmagazine.com. Available at all good news agents.
Hi, this is your own pal, Ozzy Osbourne. I love listening to Ross Hemsworth and his guests on Now That's Weird. They make me feel f***ing normal.
What you drinking? Rum or whiskey?
Yeah.
is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space itself and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area that we call... Now that's weird.
It is indeed. Welcome back to Hour 3, back live again now, and I'm getting loads of emails in from people saying how much they enjoyed Hour 2, and what a great story that Mike Oram has to tell. A lot of people chatting in the chat room as well about it, saying, you know, what's the background of this guy? Is he for real? And, you know, could he have made this up? Well, all I can tell you about Mike is I've known Mike now for several years. I've seen him speak at conferences all over the world, and his story never changes one single bit. Every single line is absolutely spot on, which indicates to me that he truly believes this happened. I can't say whether it did happen or not. Obviously, I wasn't there, but he certainly believes it did. And he has a witness, of course. You know, his good lady Fran was with him on these occasions when these things have happened. So, you know, I think you have to realise that sometimes fact is actually stranger than fiction. And I certainly have no doubts whatsoever about Mike's story. He sat and talked to me. He's looked me directly in the eye. And, you know, he seems a very genuine person. And I have to say a good friend as well. And I have no reason to doubt the story whatsoever. But I'm certainly looking forward to getting out to Area 51 myself on that tour next year. Because we're going out with Megalithic Tours on this tour of... well, starting in Sedona, in fact, and going up through Area 51 and to the little alien. And I'm certainly looking forward to that, because I believe that we might pick up something up there. I'm not saying that we'll all get abducted by Area 51 or anything, but certain things might happen. And certainly I'm looking forward to seeing the little alien in Rachel as well. And in fact, just Shamrock has just said on the chat room at nowthatsweird.co.uk, they've also travelled across the Nevada desert on a donut tyre. Not to be recommended, I have to say, and I certainly wouldn't want to be doing it on a donut tyre, that's for sure. And if any of you don't understand what a donut tyre is, most modern cars these days tend to have these thin wheels as a spare wheel inside, and they are meant purely to get you to the nearest garage. They're not meant for crossing 300 miles of Nevada desert, believe me. Right, there you go. Lots of emails coming in for Mike. And of course, I recorded that interview a few days ago while he was down in Glastonbury, so we obviously didn't get the chance to put those emails to him. But he does have a website. I haven't got the address in front of me, but I think it's inotherdimensions.com. But if you check Google and just put in there Mike Oram, O-R-A-M, it will come up, and I'm sure somebody will find it and put the details in the chat room. If you want to take part in the chat room tonight, just go to nowthatsweird.co.uk, get yourself registered for the site, totally free, Penny will get you activated, you can get straight in the chat room and chat to other people from around the world listening in this evening. I know Shamrock from America's in there at the moment, Pam from Alaska's in there, quite a few Brits in there as well, and wherever you are, you're welcome to join them. Now, my next guest this evening sent me the book that he's just written, called, and I'm probably going to pronounce this totally wrong, Les Sentiers de Dieu, Pathways of the Gods. It's about the mystery of Rennes le Château. And amongst many other things that this guy told me when he contacted me to come on the show was that he's managed to decipher one of the crop circles, which clearly says there's going to be a thermonuclear device activating at 8 a.m. on 9/11. Well, 9/11, of course, being today, the 11th of September. And 8 a.m. came and passed in both ours and America time zones. Nothing seems to have happened. So let me welcome our guest and ask the first question straight off. What's going on with that prediction? Welcome, Neil Hudson Newman.
Right. Great to be on the show, Ross. That's the first thing.
Yes, welcome to the program.
Right, wonderful. Now, let's correct one little mistake. I didn't actually predict there was going to be a thermonuclear explosion this morning. What I said is that the crop circles that I've analysed are highlighting a link between that time, 8 o'clock this morning, and a thermonuclear bomb. Now, as you would imagine, I made it my business to inform the government about this finding at a very early stage. And the crop circles also gave us the precise geographical coordinates of the center point of activity. So the government knew where the action was going to take place. They had plenty of forewarning, and obviously they stopped it. No, they're not going to announce on the news or in any form of press conference that they've just stopped the thermonuclear explosion, for obvious reasons. If people really believed that that was going to take place this morning, it would cause widespread panic. But the truth is that this government and other governments have led us into this crisis that that has resulted in people like me working my, you know, work myself to the bone trying to analyze crop circles, because our own intelligence services are totally incapable of doing it.
It is interesting, because lots of people have tried to analyse the messages in crop circles, and of course a lot of people out there believe crop circles are actually man-made, and therefore nothing to analyse. I tend not to agree with that, and I think if they are man-made, they're certainly getting help from somewhere. But it is difficult, because nobody knows for sure what they say, do they?
Well, the thing is, Ross, let us make an assumption that crop circles are made by high intelligence, or a super intelligence. Then that superintelligence would be very flawed indeed if they are producing figures in the field that cannot be analysed by the people who are looking at them. And when I started looking at them, a good friend of mine, who I think you had contact with in the past, from the Isle of Wight, Philip France,
mm-hmm.
he knew that many years ago I was a crop circle total sceptic. I had no interest in them whatever. I was convinced that they were all made by human beings. It's the type of thing when I was about 28, between 18 and 25, I would have loved to have done, seeing people running around like headless chickens trying to fathom out what I've just done in the field. But he sent me this email and he said, you tell me that human beings have made this one. And the email was about Milk Hill, the Milk Hill crop circle of 2001, the very famous one, the massive one. I had a look at it, and I became interested in it very quickly because it had 409 circles. Now, 409 is the 81st prime number, and 81 is the number of stable chemical elements that we have in our environment. And there were other links to my book, and I decided to go and have a look at it. And I didn't have a lot of time because I was just about to go to France to do some more research with my good friend Gerald Farrell down in Rennes-le-Château. So we rushed up to the circle, I surveyed it, and I changed my mind. From that moment on, I don't think that some of these are made by superintelligences. I know they are. I measured the circles, and I am an engineer. I had an experience this in the field. I measured those circles with great care. I couldn't believe the accuracy that they set them out. How could you set out circles so accurately in wheat? And when I analysed them, they were in fact a sequence of prime numbers, and it was set out in inches, and it was absolutely astonishing. And from that moment on, I've been interested in crop circles.
Well, we're going to come back to crop circles in just a moment, but let's start off by looking at the book, because it's about the mystery of Rennes-le-Château. Yeah. Now, I've done a lot of research into the Knights Templars and the background.
Yeah.
What are your main findings in your book?
Well, I think it'd be helpful to really go back in time to when Alaric the Great, the Visigoth, sacked Rome, 410 AD. Once he'd done this, and let's face it, Rome was a pretty mighty city, even though the empire had split to the east by then. It was still a force to be reckoned with, and it was a pretty big prize to get Rome and sack it. And he then headed for Gaul with his entourage and this massive wagon train of gold and other treasure. The history books then don't tell us what happened. There are rumors that he died and buried the treasure, and the treasure was buried with him. But of course, if you think about it, one of the best things you can do if you've got a treasure is to create a rumour that treasure has been buried with someone who's died. And my source in Rennes-le-Château says that this Alaric's treasure, because they headed for Gaul, as I said, and the area now occupied by Rennes-le-Château was then occupied by the Visigoths at that time. And that particular area has got all kinds of rumours about treasure there. So, in fact, it's ingrained in the local population's minds, and all kinds of speculations have been made about it over the years. But a source I came across specifically linked a point near to Rennes-le-Château with this treasure of Alaric. Now, that's very exciting. And when I first came across the data, I flew down to Rennes-Châtre to make a couple of inquiries. I wanted to establish what these little towers were. And I found that these towers had been constructed by the Visigoths. I then found some geometry. And the geometry I identified tied in absolutely perfectly with this source that linked this point to Alaric the Great and his massive treasure. So what my book is really about, Ross, is I try to show that the sources that many people have been grappling with up until that point in time can in fact be analysed. It is possible to analyse them. They're not the gobbledygook that they appear to be.
Mm.
And, you know, that's why I hope I've achieved that.
Well, I've got the book in front of me here. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I definitely will get around to doing that. But one thing that puzzles me is, how did a practicing civil and structural engineer get involved in this type of research?
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting question. It really stems back to 1980-81, when I decided to better my career and take a postgraduate degree in management. I thought this is going to be wonderful. I'll sort of really up my earnings potential by a considerable margin. But one of the projects I got involved with was to do with industrial disputes. We were given a fair sort of crack of the whip. We could choose things from a wide range of possibilities, and I chose industrial disputes. And I got a lot of information together. And when I put it all into one place, so to speak, and abstracted certain bits of information out of it, I found something that the people who'd compiled this data had totally overlooked. And in fact, they didn't think it was a parameter, and therefore they didn't even refer to it. I discovered that there's a correlation between group size and disruption. In other words, if you've got an optimum group size, you get less disruption than you do if there's, say, 10 more people in that group. Now, it seems crazy, but the statistics proved it absolutely brilliantly. And one of the things I then discovered was this number 13. I discovered that a small group of human beings seems to function well, much better, if they're in a size of 13 than they are in other groups. I thought this was extraordinary. But the more I looked into it, the more interested I became in it. And I thought, hang on, this number 13, it's ringing a bell somewhere. What is that bell? It took me a while, in fact, to realize what it was. And then I remembered, because, you see, I from the age of 10, I had totally dismissed the Bible. I have no interest whatever in the Bible or in God. I dismissed the whole idea of God, religion, the lot. And now, there I was, at this number 13, staring me in the face in an entirely different context. And I thought, hang on, didn't Jesus have 12 disciples? Didn't Israel have 12 tribes? And then I remembered from Greek mythology, Hercules had 12 labors. And in fact, mythology is riddled with this number 13. I then started thinking about sports. I said, hang on. Think. Rugby league has got 13. Rugby union's got 15. Cricket, 11. Soccer, 11. 11 plus 15 is 26. After that, is 30. So I then went to Cardiff Library and I looked at sports from all over the world.
Right, let me just stop you there, Neil, because let me just stop you there. Hold that thought, because we've got to go into an ad break.
Right, okay.
We'll come back right on this point in a moment. If you've got any questions for Neil, get them into me now. ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk. We'll be back right after this.
ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk.
In the heart of Glastonbury is the Daisy Centre Angelic Healing Retreat, a truly serene and secretly special oasis of peace and harmony. We offer accommodation and workshop facilities for groups and individuals who are looking for a special healing experience to nourish the growth of the soul. Visit our website at www.daisycentres.com. That's www.daisycentres.com. Perk up your petals with Daisy at the Daisy Centre Angelic Healing Retreat.
Hello.
Love and Light events present
the Avalon Fairy Ball on Saturday the 3rd of October at the Glastonbury Town Hall, featuring artists Brian Frow, Josephine Wall, Linda Ravenscroft, Peter Prokovnik, Chetney Davis and more. At the Avalon Fairy Ball there'll be music from the Dolmen, fairy fashion shows and much, much more. The Fairy Fair is open between 11 and 5pm and entry is free. The Avalon Fairy Ball starts at 8pm.
Tickets are £20, available from thefairyball.co.uk or 01736 330 201.
Festival Times, the UK's number one free music paper. To find out where we're giving away our paper this summer, or keep up to date on band interviews and festival reviews, check out festivaltimes.co.uk for promotions and advertising, or to buy shares in the FT for only £1. Then call the team on 0203 2875 123. Festival Times, the new music paper for new music fans. Want to talk direct to potential customers? Then think digital. Think video. Think local. Think In Your Face Media. In Your Face is a brand new media proposition targeted at affluent Bristol areas. We're currently installing digital wireless posters in wine bars, gyms and cafes, as well as doctors and dentist surgeries. And while they're waiting, they could be reading or watching your advertising messages. The technology is blindingly clever. The screens are operated wirelessly via the internet, so we can program the dynamic content that will appear on every individual screen. Slots start from as little as 2 pence. For more details, call us on 0117 942 0670 or visit our website at inyourfacemedia.co.uk. Visiting Glastonbury and looking for somewhere nice to stay close to the town centre? Then have a listen to what some of our previous guests have said about Barham's B&B. A hidden treasure, real luxury and excellent accommodation. Looked after so well in a really nice friendly atmosphere. Another 2 days at the best ever B&B. A friendly welcome, lovely rooms and a tasty breakfast awaits you at Barham's B&B. Check out our website at barhamsbnb.co.uk and for booking inquiries, simply email gene.hbarham@yahoo.co.uk or call us on 01458 837 875. Rates from just £35 a night. Take a walk back in time by visiting the Gauntlet Shopping Arcade in the High Street, Glastonbury. The Gauntlet is the town's newest shopping area, but set in an ancient walkway that oozes myth, legend, and real history. You'll find a wide range of shops offering a wide variety of products and always a friendly welcome. Visit thegauntlet.biz. The Gauntlet, Glastonbury's premier shopping thoroughfare. Visit the show's official website, nowthatsweird.co.uk, and meet the team behind the show.
Yes, welcome back to Now That's Weird with me, Ross Hemsworth, through till midnight tonight, and my guest in hour three is Neil Hudson-Newman. And we had to cut Neil off in his prime a little just before the break there. So Neil, pick up from where you left off on these numbers, if you would. Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, Neil, pick up on where you left off, if you would. And we seem to have a feed of the show coming through your telephone there. So if you could turn that down for us, that would be helpful.
Sorry, what's coming through it?
Are you listening to the show in the background there?
No. Hang on, Ross. Perhaps my partner is downstairs.
Yeah, because it's coming across the phone.
I'll just go tell her now.
Well, while he goes and tells her, I'll just waffle on for a bit. Quite know what's happening there. We're getting a feed of the show from a few minutes ago. We're coming down the phone line, so I don't know if you lot can hear that out there, but hopefully we can get that sorted quite quickly. So, Neil, are you back with us yet? Oh, he's gone off. Oh, I love it when stuff like this happens. But there you go. I normally have a few notes to sort of talk about when... hello, Neil. I was going to say, I don't know, I'll just kill some time here, you know. Yeah, if you can just pick up from where you left off before the break there with the numbers. Okay.
Yeah, well, what happened then? I was just became interested in subjects that I'd previously totally neglected. I started looking at Greek mythology, other mythology, and, of course, religion. And I tried to make sense of it. But, you know, it was a long, long process, and I just did it for my entertainment at the time.
You did it for your entertainment, but you've come up with some certain conclusions, though, haven't you, from it?
Well, I did. Eventually, I got the point that I realised it was going to be my career. That took some time. There was... what happened, just for my entertainment, I bought a book one day. It was by Linus Pauling, double Nobel Prize winner. And it was about a subject that seems totally unrelated to what I'm doing. It's about the vitamin C argument. And he pointed out in this book that every animal on this planet, every single one, either manufactures massive quantities in their body, or they have lived, they've migrated to a vitamin C-rich environment, and so they've ditched that machinery. So every single animal on the planet, in this huge spectrum of life, all of them either manufacture this, let's say, if they're human body weight, it'd be between 4 and 10 grams per day, or they lived in an equivalent environment. And the only animal on the planet that doesn't conform to this is ourselves. Mm. And it just seems absolutely crazy, because it's clear that evolution is telling us that any animal life form that doesn't either manufacture large quantities of vitamin C per day or live in a vitamin C-rich environment are going to become extinct. Because not a single animal on the planet doesn't conform to that requirement. Now, I found this absolutely stunning. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, if all these clever people, the medics, the biologists, biochemists, the chemists, all these people can't understand this simple argument, there must be an awful lot out there to learn, to research. And I decided that I was going to delve into certain matters that had interested me from a child, in fact. And when I started to do that, I was astonished at what I'd come up with. And all from that little simple realization.
Well, I think that's quite often the way a lot of us start on our quests, because it's something that will trigger us off. And certainly for me, there were a whole number of issues that did that one after the other. But one thing that springs to mind just lately, we had a lady on the show a few weeks ago who was talking about the 11:11 codes and how everyone at the moment keeps waking up at 11 minutes past 1 or 11 minutes past 11, etc., etc. And I must admit, that's been happening to me a lot. But the other defining thing is if you add all the numbers together. So, for instance, you know, you might wake up at 3 minutes past 12 or something like that, but not a good example. But when you add the numbers together, they come to 11. And you think to yourself, well, that's bloody strange, because it's more than coincidence. It's not that it's happening, you know, occasionally. It's virtually every time you do it, you add the numbers up and they come to 11. And you start thinking to yourself, what's so important about the number 11? Why do we keep getting that? So there is something, I'm sure, in the whole numbers thing.
Well, you raise a very interesting point, in fact, Ross, because it takes me on to the next point, really. After I'd made that decision to really take up research full-time, a little while later, I'd solved a good many puzzles that had baffled a lot of people for many, many years, such as the Jason Argonaut myth and various others from the Bible and many other sources. But I suddenly reached a brick wall. I could make no more progress. And I thought, there's got to be something that I'm missing out on here. Now, when I was in school, I could never accept this business about the number one being a non-prime, because we've told that one isn't a prime number, but 2, 3, 5, 7, etc., are prime numbers. So it occurred to me that maybe the people of antiquity also classified one as being a prime number. And that simple little change opened the door to the meaning of all these texts. It's absolutely extraordinary. Now, I know people find numbers boring, Ross, but I'll just say that because you mentioned 11, and of course 11 is a very important prime number. It's inextricably linked, in fact, to something I was hoping to tell you tonight. Now, the definition of a prime number is that it's exactly divisible by itself and 1. So 5 is exactly divisible by itself and 1. 7 is exactly divisible by itself and 1. But you will notice each time you've got to say and 1.
Hmm.
But if you look at 1, 1 is exactly divisible by itself alone. You don't have to say add 1. So really speaking, 1 is the only prime number. Well, that means numbers like 2, 3, 5, 7, and 11 are what can be called secondary prime numbers. So just doing that enabled me
it opened up so many doors, you would never believe it. I mean, if you had the time, I could tell you, for example, the meaning of the 7 days of creation. And you volunteered to mention the number 11, and the number 11 is involved in that, as it happens. Now, if you had time to do it, and if the listeners want to go through it, it only takes me 5 minutes, I could explain to you how God made the earth in 6 days, and why he rested on the seventh.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Right. So, if you look at the story in the Torah, the creation myth, it's very, very odd, because when I was a boy, I actually asked about this in Sunday school, and no one could give me an answer. For the first 6 days, when God is supposed to have made the earth, they keep saying, and the evening and the morning was the first day, or were the first day. And then the second day, the evening and the morning, the first and second day. And come up to the sixth, the evening and the morning, the sixth day. When they come to the seventh, they say nothing. So I thought, well, what they're doing here, for those first 6 days, they're linking each day to the number two, evening and morning. But on the seventh, they aren't. Now, if you add 12, those six doubles, to the last day, right,
mm-hmm.
you've got 13.
Right.
And 13 is the seventh prime number. And that's the seventh day. So I thought, well, what they're doing, they're telling us here that every day has to be classified as a prime number. So I then just wrote down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and underneath put 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13. Taking, of course, 1 to be the first prime. And that immediately, Ross, gives you the up-to-date mean radius of the Earth. It gives you other things as well, because the only two non-primes there are 4 and 6.
Mm.
The other primes, the 12 of them, they add up to 60. And if you multiply the 60th prime by the 10th prime, you get 6371. And 6371 is the up-to-date mean radius of the Earth. It's actually the WGS-84 geometric mean radius.
Mm.
So that simple little, just changing one into be the first prime, enabled me to understand that. But there are other things as well. The only two non-primes in that list are 4 and 6, right? And 46 is the number of chromosomes in a human cell, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you multiply 46 by the sum of the primes, which is 60, you get 12742, and that's the up-to-date mean diameter of the Earth in kilometers.
Mm.
It just goes on and on and on. There's so many things in that that are so easy to deduce. You can now see that Torah is incredibly clever. And I would say another thing as well. The Torah is known to contain five books.
Mm.
We always say the five books of the Torah. Five, of course, is another prime number. And the fifth prime is seven. And seven is the number of creation days.
Mm.
So by a very, very simple process, you can actually identify the up-to-date mean radius and mean diameter of the Earth, because the number of chromosomes in a human cell, and you've even got other things as well. I don't want to dwell on numbers here. But
it's an interesting theory, the whole thing, the way that it comes together. But let me ask you, was there a defining moment that persuaded you to abandon your engineering career and concentrate on this, Neil?
Well, basically, those two sort of points that I raised, first of all, the realization about this vitamin C argument, that so many learned people were not paying attention to it. And then this prime number. You think about mathematicians. You get any math books you want to, and I've got plenty in this house, and I've had to teach maths in a comprehensive school. They always tell you that one is not prime. And so those two points alone had a dramatic impact on me. But later, there was another one as well. It's rather interesting, extraordinary in fact, because when my father was dying of cancer, I met a cousin of mine in the hospital there, and I told him a little bit about my research, and he said, you really must meet this friend of mine, he'd be fascinated by it. He's a guy by the name of David Coggins, I don't know if you've heard of him.
Yes, we have. In fact, we were talking about David Coggins in the last hour of the show.
Oh, there we are. Well, David is a neighbour of mine. And I said, okay, Trevor, I'll call around and see this David. And I met him down Trevor's club. And David was very, very interested in what I had to say, and we decided to have a separate meeting. And what he did then, he showed me something which absolutely electrified me. Because two of the things I'd found many years ago, but I just kept it myself, because what happened, as soon as I found them, I started finding other things, and I was just amassing research. Instead of going to the publishers and getting it published, I identified two points, one in the Aegean Sea and one in the Black Sea. And even though initially my sources didn't say what they were, I later found a source that did say what they were, and they tied it to a third point in Egypt. So it's a terrestrial triangle. It comes from Egypt to this point in the Aegean Sea, which incidentally is linked to a lot of Greek mythology, and then a point in the Black Sea, which is inextricably linked to the Jason Argonaut myth. But anyway, I sat down with this David Coggins, and he told me what seemed like a very far-fetched story. Well, I took it with a pinch of salt. But when he showed me a drawing, the hairs in the back of my neck stood on end. Because he reckoned that this family had gone out to Florida for a holiday. They'd done it before, and they knew exactly how long it takes to get from the airport to their destination. And when they got to the destination, they couldn't believe the time. Because they knew what time they left, they knew they'd had no interruptions, and they'd lost 2 hours. And they were just amazed by it. But when they came back home, all manner of funny things started happening in their house. And one of them was Jeff, the son. He started getting images in his head. And the only way he could get rid of them was to put them down on paper. Now, one of these images showed an alien alongside the Earth. And it had if you put a pyramid, the bottom of the pyramid onto the bottom of another pyramid and hold them together, you get a diamond shape. So this alien was putting these two pyramids into the sea. I thought, bloody hell, it's incredible. He's actually, I've got evidence here that this research I've done is being corroborated in an extraordinary way. So anyway, I agreed with him to go up to see this family in Reading. And we were there for most of the day. My partner Shell came with us. But they showed us so much, I just couldn't believe it. They showed us crop circles in the landing carpet, for example. And they said they'd done everything to get rid of them, and nothing worked. They showed me, and I thought, I can't believe this. They had large stones delivered to the garden, which they were going to put as ornamental rockery and what have you. And they got up the next morning, and there they were, like Stonehenge, embedded in the lawn without any form of earth or anything around them. They fitted in like a glove into the lawn. And I thought, oh, this is just too much for me. So when we actually left there, and we decided we didn't want to go back there again, because these people must be nuts. Even though this Jeff had produced this drawing, which was linked to my research in an incredible way, I wasn't prepared to take in all that they showed me. But anyway, Ross, the next part is extraordinary, because more than a year had gone by, and I knew nothing about this family, and frankly, I didn't want to know anything more about them. But David Coggins rang me up about 20 past 10 one night, and he said, Neil, I've got an urgent message from the Glanvilles. And before I could say, I don't want to hear this message, David, he came around the house. Now, if you've got my book in front of you, Ross, you'll see on page 58, there's a subchapter called the 1713 Enigma, because these numbers, 17 and 13, were figuring a lot in the shadow analysis. I was working on this chapter, and as David came up the stairs, I minimized the screen so he wouldn't see anything, because at the time I hadn't published the book. He had a little piece of paper. He said, this is urgent from the Glanvilles. And on the paper was Q is the 17th letter in the 13th consonant. I've just been working on the 1713 Enigma. Well, the hairs in the back of my neck stood an end.
I can imagine. I've got to stop you there, Neil, because we've got to go into another ad break.
Okay.
But it's pretty amazing stuff. If you want to ask any questions for Neil tonight, it's ross@nowthatsweird.co.uk. And just very quickly, one email I'm going to read out just before the break. Hi, Ross, Penny and Lulu. This is from Rasmus in Denmark, who says, Ross has just said that it's more than coincidence on the 11-11 thing. I looked at my clock and it said 0029. 0 plus 0 plus 2 plus 9. Yes, it equals 11. Rasmus, it's happening to all of us, mate. It ain't just you.
Hi, this is your own pal, Ozzy Osbourne. I love listening to Ross Hemsworth and his guests on Now That's Weird. They've made me feel f***ing normal.
The proposition is straightforward. We install digital posters at any location on your premises and then stream any information you require remotely to your high-definition screens. The concept is called digital signage. And In Your Face Media is a leading business providing this technology. In Your Face Media is a young, enthusiastic company with the expertise and infrastructure to get your message across. We offer fast, interactive, animated and video marketing communication on high-definition screens in conjunction with remote media and their award-winning Signage Live software. We've installed a large number of HD digital screens in a wide variety of environments. If you're as excited with digital signage as we are, then please call us. We'd be more than happy to arrange a meeting and discuss your needs and our solutions in greater detail on 0117 942 0670, or visit our website at inyourfacemedia.co.uk.
The Hex family has been making traditional farmhouse cider in Somerset for six generations, since 1840. Using apples grown in our orchards upon Glastonbury Tour, our ciders and perry are still made the traditional way, using wooden barrels and sold straight from the wood. Try our port wine of Glastonbury, now on draft at the George and Pilgrims Hotel in Glastonbury. Or better still, visit our cider farm at 9 to 11 Middle Lee in Street, just 2 miles from Glastonbury Town Centre, and taste our award-winning cider. Perry and apple juice, as well as traditional blends. We have many single varieties like Kingston Black, cider vinegar, local cheddar cheese, jams, pickles, chutneys, marmalade, honey, Somerset Royal Cider Brandy, and a range of cider jars and mugs, all produced locally from farms around the Somerset Levels. So come and visit us today for a real taste of Somerset. Visit hexfarmhousecider.co.uk or call us on 01458 442 367. We welcome group tours, but don't come all at once, will you? Don't forget, that's hexfarmhousecider.co.uk.
Zoinkscoom! I smell something weird!
It's not weird. It's Ross Hemsworth.
You're listening to Now That's Weird with Ross Hemsworth.
Yes, welcome back to Now That's Weird. About 17 minutes of the programme still to go this evening. It's live from Glastonbury in England to you wherever you are in the world. And I know we've got listeners all over the world tonight. We've already seen on the IPs tonight Australia, New Zealand, America, Canada, South America, Egypt. I wonder who that could be, bearing in mind what we were talking about in hour one. Scandinavia, of course, parts of Europe, Spain. Thanks to all of you for tuning in this evening. It is much appreciated, and the show wouldn't be a show without you. So let's go to the emails, and we're just going to take one at the moment, and then we're going to come back to Neil, because there's so much more to talk about with him. But this one sort of intrigued me. We get lots of emails come in, and we have to sort out what sort of fits into what we're discussing. Does the guest believe that the Knights Templar were accused of horrible things because they became very rich and powerful, therefore becoming a threat to the papacy and kings, who found the solution by slaughtering them? Thank you, from Shamrock in America. Neil, what do you think of that?
Well, I think she's right, in a nutshell.
Well, of course, the Pope actually apologised quite recently, I think it was last year, for the death of the Knights Templars, because they realised that actually they were punished for something that they didn't do. And it makes you wonder, because, you know, the Saulnier Society have said for some time that, that there's been a whole wrongdoing here, and that there was money involved with the Knights Templars, and the Church were jealous of that.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting
nothing one. Changes, Ross. Same type of thing goes on today under a different sort of disguise, really.
And of course, Friday the 13th.
Absolutely.
There we go with that number again.
Nice little prime number.
Absolutely. Now, I want to come back to Crop Circles, if I may,
okay.
Because for 2 years now you've been writing articles for the Crop Circle Connector website, and we do a lot of work with Crop Circle Connector website, and in fact Greg Dyke comes on the show fairly regularly through Crop Circle season. Why are you so convinced that the formations you've been examining are so important?
Well, first of all, as someone who's been used to doing measurements in my life, when I measure these circles, and I've measured quite a few of them, I'm finding that the accuracy is just extraordinary. And having anyone who's supervised human beings, Ross, will know that you always got mistakes. In fact, civil engineering, to a large extent, is trying to make up for all the operative's mistakes. You've got to do this all the time. You don't expect to find perfection.
and you don't expect to find the type of accuracy that I've encountered in crop circles. I mean, I've been using an instrument that measures to, you know, 1 or 2 millimeters, and the accuracy is just mind-blowing. And then, again, there's an understanding of prime numbers, which I simply don't see anywhere. There's not a textbook you can pick up that deals with the subject. I don't see it anywhere at all, except in the crop circles.
Mm.
And I found many, many instances where they're referring to dates and are referring to events. I have actually told the government about a number of my analyses, and I've really had acknowledgements from, you know, even from Tony Blair. And so the government know about these crop circles, but what really annoys me about it is that they should come clean about it, and they should set up some kind of organization that systematically analyzes the crop circles. In fact, I did write to the government last year and told them that they should be helping to finance Crop Circle Connect, the website, because, you know, they're struggling to do an extremely good job. And as we've discovered recently with this warning about a thermonuclear explosion, this could have saved this country. And it wouldn't have come about if Crop Circle Connect there hadn't been putting this stuff on their site for everyone to see. Mm. And a lot of people are spending a lot of money and a lot of their time photographing them from the air and doing all kinds of things with them. And they just, to me now, I'm absolutely convinced. And I can really find within them information, for example, pertaining to geodesy, the mean diameter of the Earth, the mean radius of the Earth, and things like that. And I know immediately that I'm dealing with genuine formations.
Mm, absolutely. Now, have you any other evidence that extraterrestrials are interacting with us in any way? Because when we talk about messages from the other side or from other species in crop circles, what other evidence do you have that extraterrestrials are actually interacting with us?
Well, I'm so glad to answer that question, Ross. I really am. It takes me back to the incident with David Coggins. After that incident, I agreed to go back to see these people again. And I took their story very, very seriously. And in fact, I left a copy of my book there the first time I went. And by the time Shell and I got home, Selma was down the phone screaming. This magical table that she told us about, and I just couldn't believe. I never mentioned this earlier. They get messages on this table. They can never understand them. But when they put my book in there, it just disappeared. They just turned their backs, they shut the door, and they looked around again, and there it was, gone. And over the years, the next couple of years, I spent a lot of my time deciphering the messages on the table. And one series of messages seemed particularly strange because they kept repeating the same thing all the time. And what they were doing, they were giving me the geographical coordinates of a point in Renan Chateau, they gave me a date, and they gave me a time. And I thought, well, there's only one thing for it. We've got to go down there. Now, it was a little bit inconvenient because it was in the winter and the weather down there was pretty atrocious. There was snow and goodness knows what. So we went down there at the time and we had experienced the most extraordinary event in my life, in fact, because there were 6 of us there and 4 of us at the appointed time were almost blinded by an engulfing flash of light that filled the whole sky. And we just, you know, it's impossible to describe in words the experience. It was incredible. But 2 of the people there, that's my partner and Thelma's husband, David, they saw absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the 4 of us who were sort of blinded and engulfed by this light, we had another strange experience because we all had a terrible taste in our mouths. Now, I don't know if you've been into the generator hall in the Hoover Dam.
No.
It's very similar to that. It's like an ozone type of battery acid, type of horrible taste in our mouths.
Mm.
And all the way back to the hotel, this is 3 o'clock in the morning. All the way back to the hotel, we were in discomfort because of this horrible taste in our mouth. Now, when we got into the hotel, Cheryl went to bed, I was tinkering about as usual, I've always got papers to sort out and tidy up and all the rest of it. And I sat down on the edge of the bed and switched the light out. It was like going to the cinema. It was absolutely incredible. there I was, lying down, flat on my back, and I could just see five individuals coming up to me, looking at a point between my eyebrows, just about half inch above my eyebrows, and touching me. Now, I don't know what on earth they were doing. I really don't. I can describe them vividly. They were very, very humanoid. They're very similar to us, but they had no hair on their heads, and they had slightly pointed features. Now, I never knew what they were doing, and I didn't even try to think. I just couldn't give an explanation for it. Now, the next morning, we joined up with Thelma and her sister and David and Jeff, and of course, Thelma and Dillis had had a very similar experience. When Dillis switched the light off, there was this brilliant light and an image of this alien, and she described it as exactly the same as the ones I had seen. And Thelma, she saw a box floating in front of her with kind of hieroglyphics on it. She didn't know what they meant. But I never really knew what that experience meant until quite recently, actually, when I spoke to Blossom Goodchild. I was telling Blossom about it. And she said, well, tell me, Neil, exactly what did they do? I said, well, I've told you, Blossom. I was lying down. I could do nothing. They just came up close to me and looked. They were interested in this point between my eyebrows. I said, goodness knows why. She said, well, don't you know what they were doing? I said, no, I don't. She said, Neil, you sure they touched? I said, yes, they touched me. Each one touched me at this point of my forehead. She said, Neil, they put in information into your head. I said, well, it'll certainly make sense, because since that time, the amount of research I've done and the number of things I've found have absolutely blossomed.
Mm.
So if you excuse the pun there, I've used blossomed name.
Yeah.
But so there, I had five extraterrestrials look at me in the face. So in my case now, Ross, it's not a case of whether I believe in extraterrestrials and UFOs. I can say definitively that I've been in a UFO and I've seen five of them.
Now, I'm going to stop you on that point purely because of time, but I can actually relate to this from experiences that I've had, and I will say to my listeners again this evening, as we say many, many times, you can listen to things like this and think, well, it's never happened to me, therefore it can't be true.
Oh.
It's not the case. Many people out there are having these experiences, and they're having them on a regular basis. Now, you mentioned Blossom Goodchild.
Yeah.
Blossom's been a regular guest on the show for some time now, and in fact was on a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Now, why do you think there was a lot more to the Blossom Goodchild affair of October last year than perhaps most people have appreciated?
Well, there are a few reasons, actually. One of them, this house in Reading that I told you about, they had an independent message about that incident. Totally and completely independent. They'd never heard of Blossom Goodchild. They didn't know what the message meant. It highlighted exactly the same 3 days. Now, when I analysed the numbers, I realised that what they're actually doing, they're doing two things. One of them is they're giving us the vital statistics of the Earth. Now, that's important because I found that in all the genuine crop circles I've examined. And there they were doing it. Those three particular days that they had to be used to generate this numerical information. But, of course, there's another thing about it as well. And, you know, we haven't got enough time to talk about this year, Ross, but we've got it. It's a pretty big subject.
Hmm.
The massive spaceship was, in fact, seen, and I've tried to explain this to Blossom, but, you know, you've got to have a sort of interest in numbers to really fully understand it. The spaceship they're talking about that spanned from horizon to horizon is Spaceship Earth, because this is a spaceship. Now, one of the things that my research has revealed to me is that this Earth cannot be a random chunk of rock floating in the solar system. The dimensions of it are tied in mathematically to so many independent parameters. It must have been generated by some super intelligence whose technological abilities are so superior to ours. And when I reached this conclusion many years ago, I thought, well, I'd better keep this to myself. But I heard some astrophysicists talking on television a little while ago, and they said it's well accepted in the astrophysical sort of community that if there are any super ETs around, let's imagine it, that they've been developing for a million years more than us. And given that our technological achievements are going up exponentially, we can only imagine what these people can do. And this guy said, these beings would be able to manipulate planets, they'd be able to exploit the energy from black holes, they'd be able to do all things. So that incident with Blossom was incredibly important. Yeah. I've really told Blossom this time and time again.
Absolutely. We're running out of time now, Neil, unfortunately, and there's still so much more I'd like to talk to you about, so we must get you back on at some point to talk some more.
Nice.
Definitely. Just give us a site where people can get hold of your book.
www.milkhillrevealed.com, and between the Milk Hill and the Revealed is a horizontal line.
Okay, so it's milkhill-revealed.com.
That's it.
Cool. Neil, have a wonderful weekend. Thank you so much for spending your time on the show this evening. We really appreciate it, and we must get you back on sometime to talk some more about this.
Well, thanks. It's been a great pleasure, Ross.
No problem.
And I'll be delighted to come back again.
Thanks a lot for your time.
Okay, thanks, Ross. Bye.
Cheers,
now.
Neil. Bye-bye now. There you go, that's Neil Hudson Newman, and we will talk to Neil again. Interesting stuff, you know, sometimes it gets a bit heavy going with numbers and things when you start to think about it, but as I've just said to people in the forum, some time back we had a lady on the show talking about the 1111 codes, and I usually after the show I go and have some cheese on toast and sit down in front of the telly to chill out a bit before I go to bed, and on this particular occasion I was programming the Glastonbury radio stream up. And we have a thing called Sam Broadcaster, which is our playout software. And I turned the computer upstairs, ready to program up for the night. And I went upstairs after I'd had this chill out, cheese on toast and TV hour or so. And Penny was with me. And as I turned Sam Broadcaster on, the time came up. And it was 11 minutes past 1 and 11 seconds. So it was 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. It don't get much stranger than that, does it? Well, we're back next week with more Now That's Weird, and lots of guests coming your way as well in the weeks to come. We're going to be talking alpha wave music and frequencies next week with John Levine, and we've also got Pamela Glasner on the show as well next week. So it's going to be a cracking show, more great guests and more great stuff to listen to. It intrigues me as much as it intrigues you when I listen to some of these people and their theories, and they all seem to piece together like a jigsaw. Amazing stuff. Have a wonderful weekend wherever you are, and I hope your week's as good as mine's going to be. I just know it. I'm off this weekend to spend some more time with John Harris, www.tpuc.org. If you don't know what John's up to, check that website out now, because it could change the very foundations of the life you live. tpuc.org. And just finally, a thank you to everyone involved in the show tonight. Many thanks to my beloved Penny, who's been working hard on the other side of the room with emails, websites and activations. Thanks to Lulu for being quiet and behaving herself through the show. Thanks to Kenton, John and Mark, the people involved in making sure the websites and the shop and everything are all up and running. But thanks most of all to you, the listeners, because without you there wouldn't be a show. See you in a week's time.
Siobhan, and it's my alternative 2012 show. Very special day today, if you've noticed your calendar on the Gregorian one, because it's 999. There's any little snag with all this, you see. Of course, if you're Chinese, it probably doesn't mean that at all. So that is one of the interesting things perhaps one ought to think about, is sincerity of being in terms of belief. We'll come on to that, I think, perhaps today. It's really quite important, because I had lots going on today. Various changes in energy. And lots of interesting people coming to talk, and really quite good on the whole, I must say. The weather in Glastonbury today, Wednesday the 9th, is not too bad. We could do with some more people around there. There aren't enough, but then actually probably there never are. And for those of you not in the UK, we have all the children have gone back to school, which is a good thing, perhaps, in some ways, and not so good in others. So, what have we got for you today? Because I have the dragons with me. Those of you who've just tuned in and are, shall we say, new to my show, hard luck, where have you been? I do... I do